Well, good morning and welcome to the January 20th of 2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for coming and a reminder that if you have any electronic devices with you today, if you take a moment and silence those devices, we'd appreciate that. Today is both a study and business session, with the study session starting this morning at a little after 10, and the afternoon business session scheduled to start at 1 o'clock. We welcome public's input at our meetings and remind you that our meetings are recorded, that if you wish to address any item on the agenda, please step forward to the microphone on the table adjacent to myself here, and we ask that you please state your name and your address for the record, and if you'd be kind enough to limit your comments to 3 minutes. If you have additional comments that you'd like to make after everyone else has had an opportunity to speak, you may come back to the microphone for an additional 3 minutes. Today we have all commissioners present, General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Clerk of the Board, Rebecca Garfin. So at this moment, what I'd like to do is ask Greg Larson if he would lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance and also a safety minute.
Thanks, Greg.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, Commissioner. I'm going to speak about personal protective equipment, and I'm specifically going to speak about a personal experience that I had quite a long time ago, but it was actually, I still remember it quite clearly. I used to work in an aluminum reduction plant in between the years in college in Longview, Washington, kind of like the Alcoa plant. And one day I was doing a job in the cast house where I was pouring what was called 50-pound pigs. And the 50-pound pigs operated in a kind of a turntable-like fashion about 30 feet in diameter, and they actually kind of bathed in water underneath the steel mold to keep them cool. So this was literally the first time I'd ever done it, and I had all of the safety gear on, helmet liner, glasses. I had a device that was kind of like a screen door that would keep the heat off of you. I had a big aluminized coat on, a thick aluminized coat, and a kind of a relevant point, it was open in the back, like a hospital gown. And so literally the first time I tried to pull this little plug out of the furnace, pull a hot metal into the mold, it started to go in, and then it exploded. And so it hit me in the face, and it basically, if you looked at it, it's basically like you took aluminum foil and put it over my glasses, and then it burnt, then hit me in the nose, burnt me in the nose. Well, that was very uncomfortable. So I turned around to get out of there. It went off again, and it hit me square in the backside. The good news was one of my old mates that I went to parochial school with, I don't know if I was totally on fire, but I might have been smoldering. So he got me, put me down on the ground, rolled me out. Ambulance ride and 2 days in the hospital from the burns on my backside. But the good news is my eyes were fine, just a minor burn on my nose, and happily ever after, although that was my last summer in the aluminum reduction plant. So I had a case where the personal protective equipment served me very, very well, protected my eyes. Yes, I did get a little bit of a burn, but worked out well. So, obviously, the moral of the story is to utilize your personal protective equipment.
Yeah, very true. Story. Yeah. Wow. It could have ended very differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It worked out well. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that. Appreciate
thank
that.
You.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, commissioners, we have before us a consent agenda. I don't believe anything to be moved to the consent agenda at this time. Okay.
Good to me.
And nothing to be taken off of the consent. Okay. Very good. So we're ready to move on, Steve.
You want to move to our monthly cycle personal ownership recognition event? I want to invite Ryan Roy to come up to the table, if he would. Y'all are aware that we've spent a lot of time over the course of 2 years, but really intense in the last year, focused on independent operations, the ability to be able to operate our projects independently from the other Mid-Sea projects. It's a huge project across the district, more than 20,000 hours of work. Ryan was the lead for this, and we're certainly very pleased with the outcome, at least so far. We've got a lot of new systems out there, which has been valuable for system operators, hydro operators. We're just in a much better place to be able to understand what's going on in our system, in addition to the fact that we are able to operate them independently. But I think the reason that Ryan is here is not just because we've had a good outcome so far. Even if it hadn't gone as well as we had, I think we'd still have him here, because it's his level of dedication and his commitment to this project. He has been personally just very, very committed to making sure that we had a successful outcome, leading it along the way, leading it in terms of not just working with the group, but thinking about the types of issues that might come up, what people might need. Fantastic customer service when you think of the internal customers, the many, many internal customers that were served by this project. So we want to take a moment and just say thank you to Ryan and appreciate the tremendous work that he has done. So,
Ryan? Thank you very much. Yeah, so as many of you know, we were part of hourly coordination for, you know, since the 1970s. And so when you start a project at the district with this level of stakeholders and sort of the criticality of it, you get a little bit nervous having to replace something that's been around for better than 40 years. So we were trying to do that in two. And so, you know, I think we were able to do that relatively successfully. There's a lot of reasons for that. We had good support from the senior management team, from our project sponsors, Greg and Kirk. You know, folks like Dan, Chad, and Janet were very supportive in providing resources. A very large technical team. We had, you know, people in energy planning and trading, control systems engineers, help from hydro engineering. So it really is a project that spanned, you know, sort of broad organizational expansion, outside stakeholders like our participants, interested folks, ecology, FERC. So it was a big project. We partnered with Sapir for project management. So very good project. Happy to have had support. It was fun to work on it. It was a fire hose of work, which suits my personality fairly well. So looking for more of those projects. So it was a good project, a good team effort, good support from the district. So thank you all for that.
Well, that's great. Yeah.
No surprise, but a little story. My wife and I had gone out to dinner one evening, and it was the evening that essentially the project was coming to a close. And Ryan and a contract colleague came into the same restaurant, and the countenance in terms of their body language expression and happiness. It's two kids in a candy store, and they were very happy and very satisfied with the work, knew that it was in the right direction, and it was such a positive and great moment to see the pride and the exuberance and how meaningful that project was. And my wife and I walked out of there and talked about that pretty much all the way home in terms of your enthusiasm and the accomplishment that you had occurred, that had occurred, and your expression related to that. So thank you very much for sharing that.
It was a good day of work. We'd gone to the gym, and of course, the next thing you do is have chips and a margarita, right?
That's right.
Now we're outed.
It was perfect.
Well, thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for all the hard work.
And enthusiasm.
Oh, man. Yes.
I bet you people were, or somebody was noting that he said, this fits my personality. I want more of these kind of projects. Somebody was writing
I'm actually,
that.
Yeah. I'm actually sending Steve an email about that.
Next up, we want to get to a follow-up action item. This comes out of the fatality that we had, the accident we had at the district a couple years ago. We had a commitment to go back through and look at or create a survey to look at safety concerns and close calls. Tim Pettit has led that work for us, of course, and Joe Esty is here from Lucas Consulting to help us understand that as well. So, Tim, you want to take it away?
Morning, Commissioners. Tim Pettit, Director of Safety and HPI. And as Steve mentioned, this was a recommendation that came out of that incident, and there's been a tremendous amount of work put into this. So I'd like to thank Lucas Engineering and Joe Esty, Jr. specifically for all the work that was put in. This will be kind of a 30,000-foot view of a tremendous amount of work, and we're digging into all the details behind the scenes. But with that.
Yeah, so this is a little bit briefer than the actual report. The report will come out post this presentation as well as the safety meetings. And so there'll be quite a bit more detail in there. So as Tim talked about, we came up to provide a safety assessment, and we'll go through the details of each piece that we did in that safety assessment and some of the brief details in there. And so specifically what we looked at was the safety concerns and the close call system. And we did multiple different tools, of which on the next slide are actually, first the summary. The overall recommendations, I'm going to go through these a little bit more in detail through the slides. One would be to define and institutionalize an issues management system. We'll go through a little bit of the benchmarking we did, as well as some of the interview and survey feedback on an issues management system. Increasing the employee involvement in the process. We'll go through that a little bit more in detail. Investigating events with a team approach. And then also some of the employee feedback that we received and the buy-in on the actual remedies. So as far as the tools, when we kicked off with a survey, we came up in the April-May timeframe of last year, and we handed out surveys at the safety meeting, talked about what we were doing, and we actually had a 62% participation rate in that survey. Most companies strive to get a 5% participation rate that we work with. So that's a tremendous percentage alone. It's very positive when we go through this. Just remember that and keep that in mind. We also did interviews. We went and benchmarked, I believe, 7 different industries, a few PUDs, some manufacturing facilities, some national laboratories, as well as some prime contractors. And then we also did a comprehensive review on that safety concern and close call system, the actual data. And we'll go through that towards the end. But that's more of the timeline of what we did as far as last year goes. So as far as the survey goes, like I said, last April and May, we came out, we were at the safety meetings, every safety meeting, and went through a survey, and there were 2 pieces to that survey. One was a scale on a certain amount of questions. I believe there was 5 or 6 questions. I'll show up on the next slide. And what people thought about the questions that we were asking, such as like extremely disagree, extremely agree. I'll show that in just a second. And then we also asked for open feedback. And so there was those 2 pieces, a percentage of what people thought, positive and negative, and also specific categories and recommendations from the actual employees. And that was very important to us when we do any assessment with other organizations, having that input from the actual employees that do the work. It really helps down the road to provide solutions. There's a little bit of detail on here, and I believe you can see it. I won't go through every question just due to time. What we had asked, these are some of the questions. So, for instance, the first one, the employees believe that submitting a safety concern or a close call would have a negative impact on themselves or others. The percentage on that was 8%. And so when you look right below that, 85% of the people, which, remember, there was a 62% participation rate on this, 85% of the people were positive on that response. They believe submitting a close call or safety concern would have a positive impact on their work area. The trend is pretty close to the same on the next couple questions. I won't go through each one for you. But encouraged by leadership to submit to the safety concern system, 82% felt encouraged. If they submitted a safety concern or close call, the organization would understand and solve their issue in a timely manner. That's 79% feel confident. So another piece of these percentages, when you look at it, it's that the public utility district has to decide if these percentages are satisfactory or not. When we looked at other organizations, everybody's varied across the board. What they decide is a 60% positive response they might be okay with. They might want 99%. So it's important to know when we went through this last year and we looked at the percentages, people asked, well, is that good? Is that bad? Well, it's as good as bad as you want it to be and where you want to go. The important part is finding a baseline, which now you have, and then seeing if you want to improve and finding that definition and those standards that you want in the future. A few of the other questions, just real quick. An organization solves close calls and safety concerns with strategic solutions. That was 72% believe that, strongly agreed. Employees feeling skeptical about stopping work in the district, 84% were not skeptical about stopping. And then understanding the process, 77% of people felt that they were confident understanding the actual safety concern and close call system. such as inputting safety concerns and getting solutions out of those.
May I ask a question? Yes. Yeah. On the middle question, feeling skeptical about stopping work, I don't know if you have any way of assessing it, but maybe I feel uncomfortable. But I talk to my colleague, Randy, who then forwards it. Is that in there at all? Or
as far as that detail, not to that level, because that would be a little bit harder to track. But these were the personal surveys.
Yeah.
So the people actually answered whether they were passing it to a friend or coworker or themselves.
So it shows up in that part of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so the details on that, these are from the actual personal survey. So whichever system people went with, whether they stopped work to their supervisor, had a concern to a coworker, that it's only 11% actually felt skeptical, very small amount.
Right. Yeah. I wish it was 100%.
Yeah. But that's where some of that baseline comes from, and that's what we're working on now is what's the baseline and how do we improve? Yes.
Joe, one is to talk a little bit more about the baseline, and then I've got a question. So I'm going to ask my question, and we'll come back to baseline.
Sure.
So on item number three, first of all, I appreciate having the data presented in both kind of the positive and the negative. You know, you could read something, you know, 11% of employees don't understand when or how to submit an SC or CC.
Sure.
But then you go ahead and talk about 77% feel they understand the process.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting. You can take those same numbers and the way you word things, you can view it in a little different perspective. So I think having that balance is important. Next, the third item is, in my mind, a learning opportunity. You know, a lot of questions in my mind come up, well, why don't they understand that? Or even if it's 11%. So of all those questions or the survey results that are presented here, that one to me looks like an area that is something we can actually get our hands around and work on, and then with the baseline come back and say did we make any improvement in that area. And so I, from my standpoint, that seems like something that could be a focus for our organization.
Absolutely.
I want to make sure everybody understands how to submit those forms or that process.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
And is it the intent, Tim, of the organization to then, so doing this as a baseline, is that something on a yearly basis we're going to go back and look at those areas to gather some data to see how we're performing?
We'll go back and look. The specific time frame yearly, especially if you're using surveys, can get pretty daunting for employees. But yes, we will be revisiting these. We are working on a number of items as we speak, and I'll cover a few of those at the end of this presentation.
Great. Thank you.
And so actually, that's right in line with what you just discussed. This was the second part of that survey, which we took all the responses, which were 500 surveys that we received, and binned them, keyworded them to try to find out trends. And it actually is at the start, at the top two, people wanted more access to the safety concern and close call dashboard, how to use it, that formalized work activity for policy and procedure, which is the second one, that's directly related to the system. So how do we actually physically submit? And so that actually is exactly what you brought up. People want to know more about the system. And so that is definitely, that's more of a tangible, as you said.
Thank you.
As far as the interviews go, we followed up after the surveys, did the same thing as far as feedback categories and recommendations. There was not a percent on this because we already did that in the survey. And don't worry so much about the compliance issue with safety committee on that title. That's more of thinking when we're doing safety committees, what we need to include in them per OSHA or some other pieces. Not that it's not being done. It's just what we look at from a safety committee and safety meeting standpoint. But that was important as far as the interviews go. The top two on that one, the no status after submission, that was people have put something in the system and they haven't heard back on it. What I found out is that people are allowed to put in issues anonymously. And so part of that is that if people are putting in something and submitting it and there's no name attached to it, it'd be very hard to track back to them. And so that was one brought up by the workers, but it's also something we need to follow back on to see, you know, can it stay anonymous, but it can be by department, or that way we can get back to the people. So that's kind of a hard one. It's a technical piece. And then the second one lines up exactly with the surveys. So having access to that dashboard, having training on how to submit a concern, where it goes. A lot of people wanted to see different areas and work evolutions, such as somebody works at Rock Island, and they want to see what Rocky Reach is doing, to see if they had a concern on a specific work evolution, and how can we fix our side. And that's very good. That's very involved as far as employees go.
So I may add, the anonymity is actually, for some people, is critical. So we want to make sure that that can be maintained. But one of the processes we're putting in place is reporting back at all of the safety meetings on anything that was turned in specifically associated with that work group. So even if they're anonymous, they'll end up getting a report back of how that safety concern was taken care of.
So the benchmarking we did, as I said, we met with 7 different organizations in the time frame we could get. And we had the results. The report will have every question and what we received. I brought up just the ones that that we recommended be improved or changed. So I'll go through those, but remember in that report, there's a pretty in-depth in the benchmarking analysis. As far as the recommendations go, one of the questions was, when an issue is reported, who's the primary responsible party? We recommended the operations organization be the primary responsible party based on our own experience working in organizations and also being consultants in organizations. So having the first-line supervisor, ops manager, whoever that may be in the operations organization, owns that safety concern from start to finish. The second one is closely related, who manages the issue. The operations organization should manage that as well. Now, they have support from their folks, like safety coordinators, different managers in the different departments, but operations knows most about that problem that's going on. They're in the field at that time. And then receiving feedback for the approval and closure, that was also part of where we heard the interviews. Didn't hear much about a status after submission. So what we'd like to see, what we recommend, is that the employee is involved, if they're not anonymous, obviously, but if they're involved in the actual fix at the end. If they're doing the job, they brought up the concern, they should be able to have a piece of advice into it as to how it could be fixed. That makes sense. The last piece of this was the deep dive. So the data in this is almost half the report that we wrote. And we looked at the numbers from 2004 to 2019. It was 1,400 safety concerns and 429 close calls that we reviewed 100%. And so there was the detail, obviously, due to time, would be exhaustive to go through. So by all means, when you get that report, go through it. But the brief pieces that we noticed we wanted to bring up, and there's just 2 issues on each of them. As far as the safety concerns, we counted there were 66, in our opinion, what we've done in our experience, there were 66 incidents that were categorized as safety concerns. And so that would be something that needs to be looked at in the system, which, when I go back to those overall recommendations, defining what those are. So defining what a safety concern is, and a close call, an incident, property damage. So further defining those in the event learning standard, is, and Tim and his crew are working on that. But that was one piece that we wanted to get back to everybody to say, look, 66 incidents happen. They're categorized as safety concerns. I would definitely go revisit those to find out. And then the timeliness, that there were 38% that were addressed within 30 days. Now, in my opinion, that is a good number. But once again, the district has to decide if it's higher than that or lower than that. But they are being addressed by the safety coordinators. And so that was one that I wanted to bring up as far as the positive goes. Definitely timeliness in addressing those safety concerns. As far as the close call goes, the one part that we noticed is a large number of the close calls were closed quickly. That means day of incident. And for us, when we've seen that in other organizations, that generally means it hasn't been looked at deep enough. So when you can solve a close call, which is, you know, almost up to a point of injury, any event that can happen, and if we're closing that issue the same day, while it might happen, it'd be good to look at that a little more in depth. And that's where that team approach came from. So looking as a team at those close calls, finding out truly the root cause or some of those underlying conditions, Because what we don't want is obviously we fix it the same day and a month later the same issue happens. As far as recommendations go, we talked about it at the start, but continuing tracking and trending those safety concerns and close calls and defining what those mean. That'll help if we have the definitions of what those are, then we can actually look at what the concerns and close calls are. And then also that will help you in the future to look at metrics. So where are we at? What percentage of, you know, are being closed on a certain timeline? That only helps to improve. The note is only important. It says a decrease in safety concerns can indicate that an increased potential for more significant events can take place. Tim's going to go through more of the data on how many have been submitted, but we've noticed in certain organizations before that all of a sudden there's a drop in their safety concerns, and the organizational will think, hey, we're doing great, there's not much safety concern, and then all of a sudden we notice there's a spike. There's either an incident or an event. And what we've seen other places in certain occasions is that people don't feel as participative as they should be. They've been burned or they haven't been listened to, and so they stop participating. Now, as I said at the start of this, 62% of the people were participating in this survey and giving us feedback. So I don't believe that to be the case here. And then the long-term goals, just defining those safety concerns and close calls, having the safety committees, empowering them to help out and be included in those safety meetings, and those continuous proof of efforts, which is what we're talking about here, and Tim's going to go through that a little bit more.
So the recommendation's just a little bit deeper. So the district at this point in time still has, it's called the Incident Reporting and Investigative Standard, which has been around for some time. We are actually doing a complete rewrite, and that will be an event learning standard, because the fact of the matter is everything that occurs, we want to learn from that. We don't want to just investigate it and find out who or what was at fault. We want to find out the history on that and how we got there. So The modernize the issues management system, the safety concerns close call, how we communicate that, who it's communicated to in the timely fashion that it's done, the safety coordinator role, and the event response team are going to be covered in depth in this event learning standard. And we're still working through exactly what all that looks like, but we're making good progress on that new standard. Safety committees, as Joe had mentioned, there's compliance that we need to do in these situations. We used our safety meetings actually in 2019 to provide a lot of our human performance training as well. And so there were some competing factors there. We are in good shape right now. We've got very clear expectations on what those safety committees and what our safety meetings will look like as we move forward. A number of these, Lucas covered pretty well. I would like to cover just a couple of items, especially when you look at the historical employee safety concerns. Another item that came out of the findings was we needed to do an exceptional job in digging in and finding out what these latent issues are with employees, what these historical concerns have been that may have never been addressed. And so out of this, there was 21 of those latent concerns that were discovered. And through the in-depth survey that they did in investigations through our safety concerns and close calls, as well as the safety department, we were unable to find, even with keyword searches, that these were ever turned in. So we've got this information now, and we're treating them all as if they had been turned in and that they are close calls. I won't go through them in detail, but here is 21 of those historical concerns that were brought up that hadn't been addressed. And I'll look at just the last one, number 21, 36 auto closed gates that do not operate as designed. I personally went out to Rocky Reach, met with a number of supervisors, and finally came across an individual that said, you know what, I know what that is. And within 2 days, they had a work order in the Maximo system, and by the end of February, first part of March, those issues will all be resolved. It's just that information had been brought up, had never formally been put in, and so then we assume, and I'm going to speak for myself as a craft employee, we identify something, and we discuss it, and we move on, assuming that that's been addressed or that someone else is taking care of it. And so that's why our real focus on getting our information put into this system is critical. We believe we're beginning to see some success. Time will tell. This is the last slide. You'll see the dark blue is 2018. We had 69 safety concerns that had been turned in. The yellow is 2019. That was actually at 108 when we completed the year. And we have completed the process on 98 of those 108 safety concerns that were turned in. So a lot of focus. Safety meetings were focusing on reiterating to the employees that we need this information. And we believe that they're feeling positive about the direction we're headed because we continually are receiving them. So, any questions?
Okay. We appreciate, I appreciate you letting me come up here and present this to you.
And this is another step in the overall comprehensive response to the root cause analysis coming out of the event. So we'll be doing a broader review later this year about what we're doing across the full array of activities. But this was a big element of the recommendations coming out of that root cause analysis.
Way back in the slides, in one of the small items was a figure, I believe, 5% believe that budget is an excuse for not getting things done. And I guess, you know, I'm concerned about that.
I'm sorry, I was managing agenda for a second there,
Dennis. Okay. back in the notes, there was a 5% concern that budget was an excuse for not getting at safety concerns. And, you know, I just, is there some kind of a, is there a background on that or where would that come from? Or, because I'd like to think certainly not.
So I can speak only from my personal experience again as I was deep in the crafts for many, many years.
Yeah.
And even some of our responses at this time, and it would be myself, if there's a large, large item that's needed to address something, we're looking at some things right now that could cost a couple million dollars to solve the safety concern. So sometimes the comments are, we're going to take a look at this budget and see how soon we can get to that.
Okay.
It's simply a comment, but okay. It's heard in a different fashion.
But it's getting to it. Not that we're not going to get to it.
Correct.
Okay. That scratches my itch. Okay. Thank you.
Dennis, what page was that on?
I can find it in a second. A few seconds.
Should be slide 10.
10?
The graph takes over the number as well.
Yep. Slide 10. Looks like that.
All 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay. I forgot my glasses.
Yeah, budget constraints.
Budget constraint.
Yeah.
The third one from the bottom.
Right there. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, 5%.
Two bar graphs.
Oh, and I guess, you know, like I said, I'm relieved to know that it's not that we're not going to do it. It's just that there has to be some timing and budget acquisition and structure to being able to get to the issue.
Correct.
Okay. That's a whole lot healthier.
Commissioner McKenna, go ahead.
One last question, guys.
Sure.
On the last slide, when you have the 2019 safety concerns and the 2018, time marches from left to right, but then we've got, it took me a minute to figure this out. So the most current safety concerns are in yellow and last year's are in blue. Am I reading that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Any thoughts on, I mean, just because there's more safety concerns, that doesn't need to be a throw a red flag up and say that's a bad thing. Do you probably view it as a good thing that there's more proactive reporting being done, more education?
And we see that as they're much more comfortable to turn those in and discuss them.
So as part of our performance targets, we're actually trying to encourage more. That's the goal, is to get more of these in. So I think it's the way you were describing it. We see this as a good thing that we're getting more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of companies that we'd met with when they moved into human performance and really started focusing on leading metrics and how to create a safer workplace, they've seen a rise of, believe, Luminant was at 284%. They've seen a rise in their safety concerns.
So what might be helpful is if each year that's reported along with the bar safety concerns completed and those just march through, it might, for me, it gives me a little better way to look at that and compare those. But this is great. I really appreciate this and commend you for your work.
Thank you.
Very informative.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Commissioners, I would just suggest a slight change to the agenda because I understand we have some folks who are visiting interested in the Stehekin issue. There's no particular reason why Stehekin couldn't go next. Make it easier for them. We always want to encourage people to participate in our meetings. And so I would invite the Stehekin group to come up for the next presentation, and then we'll come back to the quarterly load growth update following this.
Good morning. My name is Andrew Grissell with Customer Energy Solutions, and with me is
Jim White, Senior Energy Efficiency Engineer.
And we're here to provide you with findings of a just completed Stehekin Integrated Resource Study. So why we're here, increasing load growth in Stehekin is leading to two challenges. The first is an immediate need. Load growth is outpacing our ability to meet peak demand with our current resources. The second is a midterm need of meeting average energy loads, or the energy needed to provide and meet loads over an extended period. A day, a week, a month. So we'll set the stage, we'll briefly provide some background information. We'll spend time looking at two challenges while also reviewing options to meet those challenges. And then we'll provide you with our next steps that we are working on. And finally, no action is needed for today. So the first section we're going to talk about is setting the stage. I'm going to go through these sections pretty quickly because I believe we are everyone is aware of this, of where Stehekin is and its unique position of being geographically isolated. I did want to mention one trend we're seeing in some of the loads that are up there is the increase in vacation rentals by owners, where cabins are being updated or built to provide for an additional tourist economy. Generally, those facilities are being more comfortable, which means having more electrical load, more electric appliances, those sorts of things. So there are three primary operating or environmental regulatory constraints. The first is our water rights. This is set in stone and determines how much hydropower we can produce. We've looked at seeking additional water rights, but believe that could become expensive, especially with additional and costly environmental requirements. Second is our National Park Service operating permit, which allows the hydro to operate on National Park Service land. And then third is an air quality permit, and this sets the parameters for how and under which circumstances the diesel generators that we have to support load in Stehekin will operate. So here's a quick look at our generation resources. Our primary resource is the hydro with about 180 kilowatts of capacity. To provide additional support, we have a 75 kilowatt secondary source diesel generator. Throughout the presentation, this will be known as D2. And these provide up to about 255 kilowatts of peak energy. There are also two large diesel generators, and these operate these do not operate at the same time. These are used for emergencies such as a long-term hydro outage where there's work needing to be done. However, by our permit, these are not to be used to meet peak load. And so these are not to be just, you know, if we need them, if we need above 255, that's not what these are to be used for.
Yeah, an important note on that diagram there is that when you reach the 255, the hydro goes off, and you're running just 100% diesel to meet all the loads. So it's a big shift at that point once you exceed the capacity of the hydro in that D2 generator.
And I want to make sure that we keep this in context, too. So that's a quarter of a megawatt of peak load compared against our over close to 500 megawatt peak load for the county as a whole. So it's a small part of our system.
Yeah, the whole community uses about what a Safeway would use. Yeah,
there we go. That was the comparison I was going to make.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's a kind of what a typical, I'll call typical, load profile on a peak day, and this was back in October of this year. It shows the load throughout the day and how the system operates. So below this line, you'll see that the hydro system is operating and maintaining the system, the power needs, community. And then as the loads increase in the morning, it begins to exceed the capacity of our hydro system, and that's D2, that's the incremental hydro, the diesel generator will come on and run to help supplement the loads in the community. Eventually around noon or so, this load's dropped off enough where the hydro can again begin to carry the load. And that there's in this particular day, there was an evening peak where diesel runs again. You can notice that on the loads, if the loads increased, the amount of diesel generation load would go up significantly. The amount of time that backup generator would run would increase significantly. So luckily, thanks to our tech department, the tech shop, and Steve Brown in particular, we now have data that's coming in remotely that we can communicate and know exactly what the load profile on a 5-minute increment starting back in September of this year. It's given us great data that we can now look at our hydro operations. We can end the diesel operations. And if we take all these loads that we've gathered, this 5-minute increment, and we stack them up from the highest to the lowest, because you're looking at this, it's very kind of chaotic. But if we take like a classroom, you put the tallest person on one side of the room and you put the shortest person on the other side of the room, and then we have everybody line up from the tallest to the shortest, it begins to make some sense out of kind of chaotic data. So this is a picture here. This bottom line shows the loads that are going on in Stehekin from the highest to the lowest, and what those loads are and how it relates back to our generator usage. Ann?
How do you know?
How do we know?
I was staring at you, right, that I had a question. Good anticipation. So I'm curious about, and it may come up, you may address it later, but so the last graph showed one day in October, right? It showed the profile in October. So I'm curious what that looks like in January. During a really, really cold month.
It depends on the number of people, bakery open, close, lodge open, close. It just depends, you know. So it's weather dependent and also dependent upon the number of people.
Does this represent kind of a middle ground, you say?
It's a pretty good snapshot.
Is it?
A lot of people there in October, high loads, got cold. That's when things kicked on, and that's when we see
and
it.
And the bakery closes.
And it was still operating while this was taking place.
Okay. All right. Anyway, thanks.
So anyway, yeah, we'll know more as we get more data. But going on to the next slide, this is kind of representative, I think, of a year. Similar, you'd see the same chart if you took it for the year. Highest to lowest. So we're operating, when the loads get above a certain point, the diesel generator comes on supplemental runs. And then what happens if we have about 2,000 amps of new service requests that have been approved? And we don't know when those things are going to come online, when that church camp's going to start operating or whatever happens. Who knows? These additional loads, new homes, et cetera, that have been approved, when those new services come on, they're going to add to that load. And if we take all of those new service requests that have been approved and add them to the existing load, this shifts this line up. And you can begin to see, as we shift the line up, the amount of time that the secondary diesel will run increases dramatically, going from 16% to 56%, triple increase. But the other thing that happens is we then reach the capacity of that induction generator and the hydro to carry the load. Now we're running into big cats, essentially what I call them. So those big cats, and that's a problem for us in terms of meeting our permit requirements and other operating, and it's very expensive.
So I want to be clear about that point in particular. So the air quality permit for the D1, D4 does not allow us to use that to serve load growth. It is there if the hydro unit and the primary diesel unit are not operating. So when we get into the left-hand side of this graph, what Jim is saying is as you move down and we start basically planning on using D1 and D4 to serve load growth, we would be operating outside the permit at that point. So that's a problem that has to be solved.
So I guess I don't quite understand. So an emergency would be when we can use the big cats. Yeah.
So,
but if we have a tremendous amount of load growth and we're trying to serve this load growth and then can't do it and the whole system goes down, then we could bring in the big cats, right? And so it could be precipitated by a spike in load growth.
Well, and how you operate it. We do, like, if we're doing maintenance on the plant, we'll take it down, we'll run the cat. If the leaves build up in the system, then it fills up, and then diesel runs out, and it runs those systems. Power outages or something. Anyway,
yeah.
Operation goes, no, we can do it physically, but should we permitting and run
it? What if it's extremely cold?
That's the question for the board. That's why we're here.
Prolonged period of time.
Good question.
So I think you combined the two issues there, and I want to just separate them for a moment. If we have an outage, so we've got to do maintenance on the hydro unit or the diesel unit isn't operating, that's what D1 and D4 are there for, to make sure that you can cover if your primary sources of generation have become unavailable. The question here really that we're now having to address is, what if it's just load growth? What if you're able to run the hydro unit and you're running your primary diesels and you still don't have enough kilowatt hours to serve the load? Now, I think in that situation, what we would likely do is we would maintain reliability. I think that would be core value for us. But on a planning basis, we're saying we really should find a way to not get to that point. We should take action to try to avoid having to be able to run the primary sources plus the backup emergency sources in order to meet load.
Yeah. We're at that inflection point now where we're seeing this in the future, and this is an issue that needs to be dealt with.
And we can't say exactly when. Mm-hmm. This is one of the problems. So it's load forecasting. And no, we don't know exactly where that crossover point is. Is it a year from now? Is it 5 years from now? We're not sure. But we see it coming, and we feel like in order to be in compliance with our permits, we should be taking action now.
So historically, the community's done an excellent job of maintaining load. You look back historically, and the loads are actually really flat. And they've done a great job of holding the line on their power consumption needs. But if these new loads come on, it's unclear as to when they come on. But as they come on, it could be as early as next year where we could begin to see an issue. Or it may be as far out as 2027 or sometime before the end of this decade.
So, Jim, do you mind if I keep jumping in?
No, go ahead.
All right, I'll forget my question. And maybe you'll address this later. So have we had a campaign up in Stehekin, a campaign on conservation? Because I think what you said was that most people have done a good job of maintaining, not increasing their load. So have we done that? Have we focused on conservation?
We have done some, and we've done some residential conservation. We've looked at some commercial. We'll talk about that in the future. Yep. We're going to address that.
Okay. Good.
How do we solve the problem? Basically what you're asking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the problems, limitations, is there's a limited amount of income that comes in from this project, small number of customers. Some of these projects that we're looking at can be quite expensive. And so these are board decisions that will have to be made someday in the future.
And the important part here, what we wanted to show was when we're looking at the cost of some of the solutions that we're looking at in comparison to the revenues that are being brought in, and you'll see that. And so those are what Jim was talking about. The questions: how are these paid for moving forward?
So these are the three issues. Yeah, meeting needs. How do we meet capacity? Meeting that peak generation need. And then you get into, once you solve that problem, then it's, okay, what's the best way to minimize the use of the diesel, and where's the economic trade-off between the two? Conservation, fuel switching, whatever the other things that we may come up with, battery systems, et cetera.
I want to be clear on here as we're moving forward. There are two problems that we're looking at. The first is the immediate peak capacity that we see where we're looking at. We don't want to plan for, and we shouldn't be planning for, using the large cats. And then the second one is, from an energy perspective over a longer period of time, what's the most cost-effective way to do that? Is it continuing usage of the diesels, or are there other opportunities out there for us, keeping in mind the retail base that we have?
So, for clarification, the 2,000 that's already approved actually causes us to exceed capacity?
It will, yes. When it comes online.
When they all come on.
Yes.
Depending on when that happens.
Okay. So, again, that's kind of what, you know, we talked about, and I know you've talked about with other individuals. You know, at some point, the county has to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Because you cannot keep permitting past your capacity, you know, for new capacity.
Let me take that one for a second and just say, yeah. I think it raises a... issues that go beyond the authority of the PUD to address. That we have obligation to serve, but there's a question here about how much growth can be sustained given the resources that are available. I think there's also a values question. What do people want in Stehekin, and how much growth do they want up there? So engaging other governmental bodies, I think there's some conversation already going on about that.
Right.
Hopefully will come up later. To think about how that kind of conversation occurs in the county and particularly in Stehekin, and it's a necessary component of moving forward.
And I'll talk about some of that in a minute, but I wanted to let you guys.
Okay.
Thank you.
So this shows what the capacity is, and really what we're working on. This is assuming the high growth rate, assuming that these things come in very rapidly, and this would be the timing at which these resources for meeting could peak capacity needs of the community. So the first one is, like, if you notice that there's the hydro, and then you got your D2 generator, and then we did some residential conservations, that little bitty sliver in here. Mm-hmm. And then one of the options that we're looking at is a battery storage system. We can take off-peak hydro and use it for meeting our on-peak needs. That can help us extend the capacity of our generation, extending the use of our hydro. We get into conservation, some water heater load control devices and more conservation, and then we start switching appliances out from electric to propane, and finally is some efficiency improvements on the hydro system. Very expensive, but gets us some additional capacity. We looked at the battery storage system. It's right now I'm estimating about $350,000 for that system. If we did this system, we could get about $125,000 grant from APPA. The plan is to put in an RFP out there to get actual pricing to see if this is within reason, within expectations, and then to make a decision whether or not to go forward with the battery storage system. But it does give us more energy, and it allows us to get more extend our hydro generating capacity by bringing in the battery storage.
I would like to just point out that last bullet point, which is something we were just getting to. It's going to be important to combine both policy solutions and the technical solutions, because if we put a battery system in and it displaces a diesel, but if load keeps growing, that window to be able to charge that battery to be able to meet that peak that we're talking about gets smaller and smaller. And so at some point, our technology is not a viable solution anymore, and we need to be talking about other ways to help those resources go longer.
Mm-hmm. And this is load growth. It just shows where the energy would come from if we put this battery system in. The diesel would drop off. We would reduce the amount needed to run our D2 generator, and then it could extend our hydro, and then later on in the year we need to do some more conservation, water heaters, et cetera, and all these other items to reduce the load. And this is how we're ranking these projects. So how we're evaluating them. We're looking at energy efficiency for residential, commercial, what does it take to put in a heat pump water heater, all these different devices. We can calculate what the levelized cost of energy, and then we can compare that to running the diesels. And then you can also see in relative to our average retail rate for Stehekin, how those shake out. They're more than the average cost of our power up there. These are the options that we're looking at.
I'll take the conclusions. First one, solutions are adding to the cost of our system, or will add to the cost of the system, where average revenues are only around $106,000. A discussion on how to fund these resources needs to occur. We need to have that discussion with the Stehekin community as well as with other stakeholders going on. From a peak demand challenge, immediate action is needed, and the battery system is the most cost-effective measure. Jim did talk about that little asterisk. That's pending an RFP where we can get more detailed information on costing. And then the other issue, reducing that diesel over time. There are options to meet growth, as Jim showed. I'm just going to go back there. There are the other options where we can look at water heating, conservation, and those other sorts of resources, but they'll add cost to the system. How much more do we want to add? And then leverage other technologies. We should look at utilizing AMI and Stehekin and looking at it, doing a more analysis on that. It could be a valuable tool for the district and community to better understand it, the usage, and where we could partner with Stehekin to make more cost-effective use of limited resources. For example, right now the average load up there is about 80% of the peak, and generally it's a lot less in most other places. And so for some reason we've got this large base load up there in Stehekin, and we don't really know why or understand why. And so having additional information, different data, could help us with the answering some of those questions to where we could do a little more targeting. Yep.
Somehow I clarify that for me. I missed that. Why is that much greater than other places?
We don't know.
So the question is, like, in the middle of the night, why are they using 80% of their energy in the middle of the night of the peak? You know, maybe this metering could help us determine, looking at the loads in the middle of the day, a person could determine
So if the peak is 100 kilowatts, that's the peak. Up there, 80%, 80 kilowatts would be being used all the time. And
even
other
middle
places,
of night,
it might be 40% or 60%.
So other places, the average would be closer to 50%.
Somewhere in there. And so we don't know why. So that's one of the questions where this could help us answer those questions and help target better target solutions towards there. But recommending to do some more analysis on whether or not that makes sense up there. So. And then just, we already talked about this point, but technical solutions are finite. We're not going to be able to serve an ever-expanding load up there. As you looked on some of those graphs, even with all the resources on those high growth rates, they're exceeding what we can find as resources at this point in time. So that's where discussions with other stakeholders, with the community, where we need to have those discussions and really try to work towards coming up with other alternatives to just the technical as well, which is where the policies come in.
That's where you come in.
Yep. And so our next steps, we're going to issue an RFP for the battery system. We're looking at early March to get that out there to understand what the real costs are on that. And then we need to set up some times and dates to share these findings with the Stehekin community as well. And we don't have those dates or times set up. I'm thinking probably sometime, maybe spring, when it's a little bit, when there's more people up there, find out when, you know, most of the folks that live up there or vacation up there are there, so that we can capture the most number of people. So those are the two steps we're working on right now. And then now we'll open up for additional questions.
So I just have a suggestion on the times and dates, and then
absolutely.
I know, Steve, you have quite a bit of information you want to share, and I have some more, but so I'll just start with this quickly. Times and dates. Do we have anybody here from Stehekin? I thought so, yeah. So I'd like to see us get input from some of the Stehekin residents and find out when people start coming back up. And it might be end of March, it might be April, but I think it's really important. Well, first of all, I think it's really important we give them a lot of lead time. I've had a number of people contact me, and they will want to arrange to be there. So we need to give them some really good lead time to make sure they can get there. And so I don't know what that is, but I think we should ask that question and find out from the local people. And Steve had a suggestion. Bob, who's our operations guy up there, he could help us with that too. But I mean, our gentleman in the audience might might have some input on that.
Maybe at this point it's appropriate to invite our guests from Stehekin. Would any of you like to address the commission? Please, if you would, step to the microphone and state your name and address, please.
My name is Mike Miles. I'm 294 Rainbow Lane in Stehekin, although we just make up addresses because there are none.
Thank you.
My license is 100 Yellow Brick Road. I moved to Stehekin in the early 70s, and I was actually a backup operator at the power plant for my farm recognition. Back before all this automated system, during those peak times you talked about, you'd have to physically go up the plant, start a hydro, sink it with a diesel, come back a couple hours later, shut it off. You know, there was no automatic come on to a diesel in the middle of the night. You just had to go to start it up. Of course, now it's all automated. I was just curious that the University of Washington did a solar study in Stehekin in the early 2000s, and at the same time they kind of looked at the hydro plant. It seems to me they came up with an option of replacing the Pelton wheel with some type of turbine that was more efficient. I know it was very costly at the time. I just wondered, is that an option to help increase the...
Yeah, that's one of the items that we looked at. It's very high capital cost to get there, and so it actually turned out one of the more expensive things that we can do, but it is certainly an option for doing that. It's called, there's a turgo, or you can add multiple jets to help it improve the efficiency.
All right. And as far as the time for meetings, I think like mid-May, you know, most people come like Labor Day, Memorial Weekend, I mean.
Oh.
You know, mm-hmm.
Seasonal people. You know, I don't know about the base being so high in the nighttime, but I know several years ago the PUD was came to Stehekin and tell people to put timers on their hot water tanks and have them come on during the night to balance the load out rather than coming on at 7 or 8 in the morning.
That maybe they've done that, and that's why it is what it is, but the clocks tend to run different times. They've sent our rate schedule and policy to allow that, but we haven't. I don't know if we have a program like that going on right now.
And also, you know, people in Stehekin have helped manage this power. Everybody
takes
it very seriously. A lot of people have, like me, for instance, have started, because you had fires going all winter in your wood stove, heating your hot water with your wood stove, which helped a lot. A lot of people do that. Except the seasonal people have, like say, electric heat, but they're not usually there in the wintertime. But I can imagine electric heat would be a big issue for anybody in Stehekin. Not that many people have electric heaters. Most people live there full-time, cut wood, including the school.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Heat in the school.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I can save money there. So my big question here was Mike Scherer. I saw some PUD people talking with him earlier this fall, and I'm just wondering what options did you offer to him rather than using electric heat?
So we were looking at ways to supplement his heat with the wood. He's got that wood boiler for his hot water needs to add it to that. Any other ways that he could help conserve and work, we could work together to reduce his loads on the electrical system and still help meet their needs that they need for heating, space heating, et cetera. So.
I was, after I retired from the Park Service in 2005, I was a maintenance supervisor for the school district there, and we were trying to replace that wood boiler because the school district statewide have kind of banned those wood boilers. They're actually illegal to sell in the state of Washington.
Oh, really?
I found out through the EPA. Because they're idling so much, there's so much smoke released when they're idling. When they're automatic, so I don't know if that's something they've looked into.
I'm not aware of that.
Just curious.
Yeah.
It's a great idea. Unfortunately, they're not legal for the EPA, especially for schools or public use. Anyway, that's all I got.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you
it.
Much.
Appreciate your comments.
Thanks for coming down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Any of other guests like to make a comment?
Hi, my name is Teresa Kulik, and I live here in Wenatchee. But I have a cabin and have been using it in Stehekin about 30 years. And this is all very informative, and I think people will pay attention to it, and we have been. When I say we, folks in Stehekin and I know, have been working hard on conservation issues. And we've been paying attention to climate change and a number of things. But my main point here is the person that is working for you at Stehekin, Bob Nielsen, is incredible. And he demonstrates everything that's good about the community. And I've seen that firsthand in Stehekin. Excuse me. I've also seen it with your employees here in Wenatchee. So I have
dual perspective of how good your service is and how much you care about providing excellent service to your patrons. But Bob is outstanding. In the middle of the night, he'll be out there in 2 feet of snow. I mean, the guy just doesn't quit. So thank you for providing that service to us.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate that. We'll make sure that Bob knows.
Yes. Finished with Commissioner. Yeah. Anybody else?
Anyone else like to make a comment? And I think Commissioner McKenna, you're on.
Thanks, guys, for a really informative. Every time I go up to Steakon or I hear information, it's for a little tiny place that is really not changing very much. It's actually changing quite a bit, as we're seeing from electrical load and the. And for me, the question becomes, what do we really have in our purview as responsibility and authority to impact that? And I think you guys have done a good job. In the short term, there are things that we can do, and staff's done a great job, just as this lady just shared with us. And I apologize, I forgot her name already.
Teresa.
But in going up there, what I've really discovered is a lot of conflicting wishes and desires. And it's going to be very, just like any other community, it's hard to get everybody on the same page and in agreement. Mm-hmm. But the people up in Stehekin are this marvelous community of full-timers, part-timers, staff people with the Parks Department, just a lot of great people up there. But not unlike my town of Leavenworth and Chelan and other places, things are changing. And outside influences in the area of Airbnb-type accommodations are having an impact on things. And folks that I talk to up in Stehekin want people to come up and participate in their services, and it's their businesses. Other people want it to stay very small, and lots of conflicting priorities there. But I, you know, just as you talked about wood-burning stoves and the park department and policies, there's some policies that over the years historically have been kind of battled out, and we want to make sure that those policies, the Parks Department is a key player there too. So I just wanted to share with you that the Chelan County Commissioners, the Port, state representatives, we've been talking, we've been meeting, and everybody has an interest in having further dialogue with this. And so we've agreed, and the Port has offered to facilitate a discussion to continue to have those discussions. Whose responsibilities? What policies can we influence? What policies do we have authority to influence? What can we do to make steps that make sense for everybody who lives there and everybody that's visiting, and how do we keep things balanced? So the Port District has agreed to start that process, and I think that'll be a precursor so that when we have these community meetings, we're involving all stakeholders and organizations in that dialogue to see what solutions to the challenges that are facing up there we can proactively engage in.
Mm-hmm. You feel that it would be beneficial for that group to, you know, came and provided them this presentation as well?
Yeah, so that's the plan, is to get started with that group, mm-hmm. Kind of a preliminary discussions to lead ongoing discussions down the road. What are the ideas, how to do that? Have this presentation, listen to airport roads, building permit discussions, you name it, air quality, all those things that different agencies have, start having those discussions, ongoing discussions, and then prepare for these future discussions with stakeholders up there. So I'm looking forward to that. I know, Andrew, you've been asked to participate in that. Anne and I have volunteered to help with that. And so I look forward to that. It's really an intriguing, I mean, I love the place. I've been going up there for years. And so I think it's very proactive that we're going to start these dialogues with different organizations and prepare to have those future community discussions down the road.
Go ahead, Commissioner Congdon.
When's our next Tri-Commission meeting?
Thank you.
Oh, so it's a ways off. This would be ideal. That would be a perfect venue to present this. But you may want to start before that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But certainly that's a place that the next Tri-Commission meeting we should, I think, have this on the agenda. Because it is the county, the port, the PUD, and you know, mayors. And then also, I've been contacted by several people. One in particular, Judy Clark, is an old timer. She owns property up at Stehekin. Her grandpa owned property up at Stehekin. So she's a resident there part time. You folks probably know her. Anyway, she sent me, she was unable to attend today's meeting. She wanted to be here, but she had promised somebody a trip to the hospital or something. So anyway, she sent me lots of information and wanted me to share it, and I did forward it to all the commissioners, and just this morning, yeah, because I had to do some switching around. She said she's not very good on cut and paste and that sort of thing. But anyway, so I forwarded it to you and to Steve and to Justin, I should get it to you. But anyway, she just has some ideas, having been a long-time resident up there. She, like I said, she's an old-timer, which definitely makes me an old-timer. But ideas on conservation and what could be what's possibly happening up there and kind of the changes. And something I was just going to say that's interesting, you talk about the conflict now up at Stehekin. There's been conflict in, I mean, that's been the way of life forever. When the Park Service came in, what year did the Park Service come in, Mike? 68, yeah. Oh, so my dad and my uncle were, I mean, you know, they were heavily involved in that whole thing. And that set forth, you know, so much conflict. And it continues. So that's nothing new to the residents of Stehekin. And it may be, it's changing, but, yeah, anyway. So, so Judy Clark has comments that she shared, and I have other people. I will forward everything on to commissioners and make sure it becomes a part of the record. Okay. But Thank you for all you're doing. We, you know, this is important. It's like you say, it's a small piece of our load up there, but it's critical. Mm-hmm. And I love the place too. I've been going there for 72 years. I don't think I've missed a year in 72 years.
Yeah. All right.
Anyway, thank you.
Well, I think it's a much healthier, proactive situation than just saying, sorry guys, we're going to put a moratorium on everything, and I'd rather be proactive and come up with solutions than to get to that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So don't let anybody hear that and freak out and say, no. Oh no, the PUD's considering putting a moratorium. We're not.
Okay.
We're not.
Yeah. I mean, we're being proactive.
So I have a question. I couldn't help but notice in your notes initially you said that the Park Service was the largest user of power. Do we have any idea on the characteristics of that power? Does it resemble a residential use, or does it resemble a commercial industrial use?
Well, there's a combination of both. I think that comment referred to Park Service employees and the facilities that they have. So there's residential and commercial facilities up there that they have, seasonal employees that live there and work, as well as the lodge is a big consumer, and that's a Park Service lodge. And then you have the Discovery Center, the other facility that they have there. And that's actually very low, pretty relatively small, considering the size of that facility.
So does their characteristic at all lend to this high base load? Is it since they are your largest customer, I mean, it would seem to me that they
have the
ability to move the needle.
We don't know yet, and that's where all we have is monthly data, and so we don't know when that energy is used during that month.
Right. The data we showed where we were showing that 5-minute data, that's the data at the hydro.
Sure.
And so it's not going out and finding information on we don't have that capability at this point in time to be able to understand the individual loads.
And you'll be dialing them into the discussions. They'll be part of the discussion group.
Correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. We're going to need to, not only policy-wise as it pertains to firewood access, et cetera, but just as a user, they have plans for expansion as well. So we need to involve them. They need to know what we're looking at and have those discussions as well.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you.
One last question. Would it be possible to get a breakdown or a look at the characteristic of the proposed 2,000 kilowatt proposal?
2,000 amps.
Amps. I'm sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Would it just the characteristics of that and how it breaks down in terms of users? And
potentially.
Yeah, we should be able to get that. From
we'll look into like that.
The church camp, how much load they're going to require.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. I'd like to just finish with a couple other factual points. First of all, so congratulations to these guys. They made a decision way back in the spring to pursue the grant from APPA, even though we didn't have this analysis in front of us. And so the fact that we've been successful in getting that grant has put us in a much better position today. Having said that, I do want to say the battery conclusions that were drawn here were based on Jim's estimate of what the battery would cost. Until we get through the RFP process and we actually see that, we don't know what that cost will be. So I want to make sure you understand that that's a big, important next step for us to get that RFP out. We're able to do that under existing authority. We don't need a board resolution to move forward with that. So AMI would be beneficial here, but I do want you to know implementing AMI in Stehekin was not a part of the original business case. So the way they describe that is this is a consideration. You know, obviously, you get much better data, but we're always looking at, so how much better is the data versus the cost that we actually would incur? So again, a small system. So we've got some work to do to just figure out whether we would do that expansion on AMI. And then the policy question, just want to bring this home and say this is not, although it's on a much, much smaller scale, it's not different from the cryptocurrency discussion. Recall that we basically said we can put temporary moratoriums in place. We don't have the authority to put permanent moratoriums in place. The only way that we can manage this, if we really are trying to manage load, is through rates. And so then you have the rates questions that are out there. We already have tiered rates. We could talk more about how we might alter rates to be able to address this. But the first thing you'd want is the feedback from the community about how they feel about growth and what the options are for addressing that, I think, before we would jump in and start to take positions. So wanted to make sure we were clear on those points before we close this conversation.
Yeah, so one last question, I promise. So if Mike said that a lot of folks will be back mid-May, closer to Memorial Day, do we need to get input before that? I mean, I suppose we could have a meeting up there, say, mid-March, And then again in May or early June when more folks are there.
I know that we're also communicating information, sending information out, emails and letters, et cetera. So that is another way. It doesn't have to be a formal meeting necessarily to disseminate them, to pass out the information.
Yeah, so I guess weigh everything and his consideration of dates and then let us know.
I think there's one decision that we don't understand the timing on yet, but it could be that a delay would impact that decision, which is whether to proceed with purchasing the battery. Mm-hmm. So we get the feedback, and we do have the grant. The grant is there for a period of time. We'd have to work with APPA about how long they're willing to hold before we would choose to take an action. We need to work through all of that. We don't have a conclusion for you today. We didn't actually know, we weren't sure when the right time was for the meeting. So the first time we kind of thought through this, well, it might be as late as May is a new thought for us. So we how about if we come back to you about how we put all those pieces together?
Well, I think in the big picture, you know, we did go up last fall or last spring. I can't remember when we went up.
September-ish.
Yeah, I think it was late summer.
So we're following, that was a great great weekend of visiting with people and getting information. And we're doing work. We're applying for the RFP. We're going to meet with several entities. We're going to go to the Tri-Commission and then the spring go back up to the community. So I think that process seems very healthy to me and timely.
It's just one commissioner. I'd rather see us get up there within a couple months, meet with who's there, get the feedback that we can, and then go back again maybe in early June. But that's just one commissioner's opinion.
We'll get some more information about how all the pieces fit together here and bring it back for a conversation with you.
Well, for sure, share this information. I mean, that'd be worth a trip up there just to share that new data and steps that are being taken, talk about the battery, just share information. Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Well, we'll take all this information we've got today, input, and we'll put together a plan, and then we'll share it with everyone.
I just want to say one thing because it's gnawing at me, and that is that the some of the options can be quite costly and expensive. And at the end of the day, I want to be a very good steward of what electric rates are in the Stehekin area. And so even though we can have the biggest, the best, the most expensive option, that might result in some additional costs passed on in rates in Stehekin. So I would like to avoid that. I would like to look for more of a let's provide a through conservation, through working with the county, with the port, through looking at technology and ways that we can conserve, rather than reaching for the biggest bang on the shelf that's going to cost the most and result in rate increases in Stehekin. So, again, it's one commissioner, but I can see how this can turn into something that's a pretty expensive mousetrap, and I don't want to pass those costs on to Stehekin.
Yeah, that's fine, too. Yeah, so that's what we did. We did rank them from highest to lowest cost in terms of the cost of energy, of providing that energy. And that's how we sorted them out to determine which ones would be first. And some conservation is much more expensive than others. And how much bang for the buck do you get? And we've looked at that.
And one of the rows to look at is values. Incremental peak reduction. How much can we actually get to make an effort to? Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind as we move forward.
I'll be keeping my eye on that. Exactly. And maybe even grants through the state to help reduce that cost and reduce that burden on the folks in Stehekin. And whatever we can do to keep those costs down, that's what I'm going to be paying close attention to.
Okay.
Could you break down tiered rates for us? I mean, not now, not today, but can you get that to us, what those look like right now?
Yeah, we have that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Jim.
Appreciate it.
Andrew.
We will return now to the regularly scheduled agenda. And,
thank you, folks, for coming from Stehekin. Yeah, appreciate it, and thanks for your comments.
Well, welcome, Andy, to do the quarterly load update.
Good morning, commissioners. January 20th, we're here for our first quarterly update. Today's agenda, one of the core deliverables for these quarterly updates is the 10-year load forecast. We're also going to take a look at electrical trends, but also new to the quarterly update, we added a few trends about our water and our wastewater services as well. We always take a look at those large customer projects, and then, of course, all of this growth translates into capital infrastructure substations. So we'll give you a quick update on those. There's no board action today, but we always appreciate your questions and comments. Through this window of planning and forecasting, some key points are we continue to see growth in new construction, primarily in the residential area, but also some commercial and industrial growth as well. Load projections reflect primarily a settling out or a stability, if you will, in the high-density load and the cryptocurrency environment. So we've seen that trend for a while now, and we feel that's baked into our load forecast. Regional planning efforts continue That means we're talking with the counties and the municipalities about where they think the growth is happening, and we're trying to reconcile that with infrastructure. Substation construction and property acquisitions for future substations is still forefront in our capital planning and our capital work plans as we move forward. And of course, we just heard about how technology can help us solve problems, particularly in the load forecasting and load management areas. And certainly, we're starting to see traction with our advanced metering system, outage management systems, and advanced distribution management systems, all technologies that will help us in this spectrum. 2020, indicators show that we will bring more new construction into the county, as we've seen in previous years. And some of the trends that we're seeing there is the city, Wenatchee in particular, has adopted more of a high-density zoning application. Also, the creation of the opportunity zones, that hasn't necessarily translated into new growth and expansion at this point in time, but certainly it's positioning for that to happen. That opportunity zone is primarily in that Wenatchee South down to the Malaga area. The Foothills development, I think a couple of load forecasts previously, we talked about, you know, a forecast of somewhere between 12 and 1,500 new residential units west of Western into the Wenatchee Foothills. And we'll show you how that's actually translated into new applications and new developments in those areas. For some reason, Wenatchee likes to build new hotels, and we're continuing to see new hotels coming into our arena. Here's just an example of some of the growth in existing business as well as new arrivals. The Slidewaters area's got a new wave pool for surfing. We've got the Diamond Foundry. We've got the Lowe's Trust on the port property in Kashmir, as well as Beta Hatch, which is utilizing the treetop facility in Kashmir, and the expansion of the Leavenworth Icicle Brewery. So, you know, 10 years ago, who would have thought that Wenatchee Valley is growing bugs, beer, and diamonds, right? It's not just apples anymore. This slide shows an example of developments within the Wenatchee area. Now, this is not inclusive of all new residential developments. There's a lot of them within the city limits that aren't shown on here. Just wanted to just give you an example of how the foothills are expanding. These are developments that are in the planning spectrum. We've either got applications on them today, or we're having conversations with developers about them. There's one correction on here. The Triad 431 residential lot should really say residential units. We don't know for certain if those are going to be individual lots or apartments or condominiums. Nevertheless, that's a lot of...
What acreage is that development on, do you know?
I don't know how many acres that is. Yeah, I can get that information. What is standing true is that the development sizes are the number of acres. We're seeing a trend of more units or more lots per acre
than we have
in the past. Higher density. Yeah. That's for certain.
That's a big number.
That is a big number. And as we know, our water system surrounds the Wenatchee Valley floor, both in the Sunny Slope as well as the Wenatchee and South Wenatchee areas. And so these developments alone will translate into over 550 new water connections as well. So we've largely talked about electrical load growth in this meeting, but also we can't forget that we will see new water installations as well. Fortunately, our planning forecasting saw a need for a substation in that particular area, as you well know, and the Castle Rock substation will probably move into our planning and construction vision here in the next couple of years to help support the development and growth in that particular area. When I said high-density zoning, this is an example of the Queens Court. It's in concept at this point in time. This is at the head of Number 2 Canyon, but you can see that high-density zoning applications would translate into something like this, where the lots or the units are narrow, but they're moving up in height, so more multifamily and cluster style units. Shifting gears into we wanted to show you just a look back over 5 years of number of new electric water and wastewater meters. You can see in 2019 we are north of 52,000 meters, 52,128 to be specific. That's translated into over 2,500, almost 2,600 new meters over the last 6 years. And on the water system, we've got continuous growth as well. We're almost 6,300 water meters with a net of 490 over that six-year period. That look forward on the water system looks very similar to that, possibly even more. And our wastewater systems, although slower growth, we do see some incline there as well. Our active projects, these are projects that we've had applications in since October of 2019. Again, I just remind the board that the numbers on the right-hand side in megawatts are actual what our engineers look at from a peak loading standpoint. So it's not energy, that's peak loading. We have a total for those projects, a little over 6 megawatts of peak loading for those units. See, much of that is residential units and or housing, and some substantial numbers of hotels as well, and then two big energy applications, the Beta Hatch in Kashmir, as well as some commercial space in the Peshastan Mill Pond area. So the growth is spread out from the north end of the county to the south end and east and west. All that translates into a 10-year load forecast for us. And again, just a reminder that this is net energy conservation, and without our energy conservation experts, we'd be looking at load growth substantially higher than this. So they do a fantastic job for us. Our current forecast as of December 2019 is looking at a base forecast of 26 average megawatts. You can see we still do have a perspective of a high case and a low case. We think the probability of the base, or right around that base, is a very high probability. You can see since June of 2019, on top of the slide was 48 average megawatts. September, that was reduced down to 32, and now we're at 26. That primary reduction on that look forward is directly associated with no new cryptocurrency applications or high-density load applications or inquiries. So when I say that we think that that's settled out, that's where that's coming from. So that was a large influence on our focus over the next 10 years. In addition, the base case assumes what we view as kind of the average economic development perspective. Okay. Moving on to substations, we have had some progress. The picture on the upper left-hand corner is October of 2019. This is actually the Holly Street or the North Wenatchee substation expansion. So you can see I'm doing some grading. And then down here in January, we took a photo that shows the two power transformers. So those are the big ticket items in that substation. And together, those combined would be 56 megawatts at that particular substation site. So our substation spectrum, or our stack of substations, if you will, from the top to the bottom, Omi Garden, which is out there, an old station. The site design is completed, and we do have two transformers, similar to the transformers in the photos, sitting on site, and we're working to get the final grading and conduit installations there. So a lot of activity in Omi, as well as the Diamond Foundry. The Wenatchee expansion, a very important substation to us, so we're going to have a general arrangement and site planning done around Q2 of 2020. Beyond that, the Chelan Gorge, that transmission line that would feed the substation in the gorge is being looked at very carefully right now. We are not going to anchor on a final substation location until we're more informed with what we can do with routing a transmission line into that general vicinity. But we should get some results around the second quarter of 2020. On the North Shore and Leavenworth, we've engaged with a consultant to help us navigate through the final site planning and the arrangements. This is really the opportunity for our community to weigh in heavily on the aesthetic attributes or the noise or the lighting attributes that they've expressed concerns with. So we'll be developing, and we have been developing, community advisory groups maybe the wrong term, but just engagement opportunities with those folks that are adjacent to those substations to help us navigate through those. So we'll be bringing some updates back to you specifically for the North Shore and the Leavenworth substations from the aesthetic standpoint. And the two mobile substations, very important for our reliability, are delivered in the second quarter of 2020. So All that to say, there's a lot of activity in the substations, and we'll keep you up to date every step of the way there. For 2020, one of our primary action plans in this spectrum for growth is that we, as a derivative of the strategic planning effort, we committed to bringing back some alternatives and options around how we're recovering costs for line extensions today. Line extensions can include both that infrastructure to extend the existing power from its current location onto properties, but also line extensions can include costs for upgrading existing lines, substations, other infrastructure that is in place today. So we're going to rethink some of those things and bring forward some alternatives. And I think by the end of the Q2, first part of Q3, we'll be bringing some of that information back for the board to consider options. So in summary, growth continues, very similar to it has in the past, but it seems to be manageable growth for where we're at today. Load projections are reflecting the stability of the high-density loads or the cryptocurrency, the settling out of that market. We are continuing those regional planning efforts, and we'll be facilitating some upcoming visits with municipalities, other governmental entities that deal with growth and expansion. We'll be sitting in rooms together, having those conversations, very similar to the conversation that needs to happen in Stehekin, with some of the same stakeholders. So substation construction and property acquisitions are continuing, and these technologies that we are aggressively adopting and working towards over the next year to 3 years, AMI, outage management, and advanced distribution metering systems, will all help us in this spectrum. And so we appreciate your support, both financially and politically, to help us get those in place. Any questions or thoughts that I can answer?
No, just the recent one, the new apartments that have been being permitted at 5th and Riverside Drive, 455 units. Yeah. That's impactful.
Yeah, that'll definitely be impactful. I will say that the work or the visioning that took place between the city of Wenatchee, the Port District, and the Chelan County PUD in terms of recognizing growth and expansion on the riverfront, translated into infrastructure, both substations and underground power lines along the Riverside Drive years ago. And those visions really will help us in terms of meeting those load growths today. So I think the 455-unit proposal, although impactful, I think our infrastructure is in good shape to be able to accommodate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good presentation.
Thanks, Andy.
Commissioners, I would propose, I think we've got about a 15-minute item that's item 8, and it might fit best in the time that we've got. So I'm going to suggest we jump over to the alternative contracting mechanisms discussion, and we will come back to the Rock Island license either if we've got time before noon or this afternoon. Welcome to Dan and Brett.
Good morning, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services.
Good morning. Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management.
So we're going to give you, it's kind of a update of where we are with the GCCM and design build, the alternative contract methodology, and what we're experiencing. So give you a little bit of background information, why we're using them. Talk about lessons learned. So this is a good time. Lessons learned on the kind of end of the projects a little bit. And one of the reasons we wanted to be here today was talk about how the board is going to see things a little differently when different actions come to the board through these methods versus our typical methods, and actually get into a little bit of discussion of how we see the future of design build and GCCM, and then provide a recommendation of some potentially impactful legislation that will be coming forward. So quick recap, design, bid, build. We've been doing that for over a century. It's how we've done most of our work. The reason we have those is because of, it's a tried and true method. But as we got into other ways of doing business, we see that there's some other methods of achieving better outcomes. And so one of them is the general contractor construction manager method. This is what we're doing at all our facility projects. So we still have a design consultant We select them based on qualifications, as we always have, but we also now have a general contractor that we select via qualifications and price. The construction is competitively bid. The sub-bids provide that ability to make sure that you are getting the best price. And then the primary role of the GC in that process is kind of as a construction manager, as a collaborator. So it's a lot different than the design build.
In the design build method, this is where the owner contracts with one entity to design it and then also build it. The difference between that and GCCM, again, is that GCCM contractor may not build any of it. They may build up to 30% of it, and then they manage the other subs. So design, build, they design it and build it for the owner. And it's a two-step process. The first is there's a request for qualifications that goes out to anyone. It's wide open. The next is then a shortlisted group of people then put together proposals. The owner selects one of those proposers and then endeavors to do a great level of detailed design. The RCWs don't specify what level of a design, so the owner works with that contractor until they think the design is sufficient to lock in the scope. And then that design builder will come up with a guaranteed maximum price. And then if that guaranteed maximum price is acceptable and the commercial terms are acceptable, then they go forward and build the project.
So back to a little bit of history of why we're doing these. So back in the 1980s, we had some very large state projects that came in, and really that bid day, bids came in way over estimated costs. And there was a lot of forensics. Why are we here? Why are we at this point where we can't award contracts? And so we looked at other states. Washington State did the right thing. How are others doing it? And they looked at other states that did something called general contractor at risk, is kind of the general term. And so back in 1991, they said, let's try it with prisons first. So the Department of Corrections got authority to do a prison project, was very successful at that. They expanded it in 1994. I think they created an oversight group in 2005, which gave us the CPARB, we all love our acronyms here, and the PRC, which is the Project Review Committee, were created. And then the legislation just kept getting extended, and the current sunset date of this legislation is 2022. So we have something coming in the near future that we're going to have to look at as a state. Do we want to keep doing this? And we'll talk about that a little more in the end. But the real reason was better bids, better quality, better prices, and ability to award contracts. So the process of GCCM, we select a design team, same way we select it for design bid build. We select an architect or an engineering firm. Then we select a GCCM contractor based on their qualifications, experience, and price. And what's really nice about that is you get to blend the three things that make a project successful. So we've had contractors that we'd really love to work with bid, but they're too expensive. In this case, we get to use all three of those, so you have the best partner in the team. Then we work together, the owner, design team, and the GCCM work together through that design process. And we have a small contract for what's called pre-construction services with the GCCM, and they help us do things like constructability reviews, cost reconciliations, and you continue that process through several iterations up until you have a fully designed project. And then you do sub-bidding of that work. As Brett referenced, they can do up to 30% of the work or none of the work, but they sub-bid that out. And so we have good cost control in terms of these are truly market prices. And generally speaking, the GCCMs like to do about 30% of the work. It fits into their way of doing business. And so then once you get those sub-bids together, then you negotiate the guaranteed maximum price, which are all those sub-bids and some of the support services that go into a contract like this. So very different process than design it, put it on the market, and hope for a good bid day. What are the benefits? The benefits are all that input from the GCCM. So sequencing and phasing, they can help us look at what types of packages should go first. When should we do concrete? When should we do a move-in? It's been a lot of work with the phasing and the sequencing of the work with our GCCMs. Coordination of the work, so what trades should do what things. Maybe we can break up the work a little differently, break up those sub-bid packages. Cost reconciliation, this is super important in the process. So this is where we think our engineers' estimates line up with contractors who are going to bid the work. this is not having that uh-oh bid day. You do it early on, and you see where your numbers are different. And it's funny that there can be some very basic misunderstandings that happen on bid day, and we get all those out of the way so we know what the contractors are thinking. Constructability, you can talk to the subconsultants or subcontractors. You talk about materials. What's the market doing with steel right now? Should we go with concrete instead of steel? You have all those conversations early on. And then when you do those cost reconciliations and you see there is a discrepancy in the bid price versus what you're expecting, you can start value engineering like a 30% design instead of waiting until your value engineering right at the end. A lot of collaboration. So this team-oriented process, we have constant meetings with our GCCM early in design, and it lowers the incidence of claims. You have more certainty around the cost and the schedule. And in the end, you've selected the team you're working with based on their qualifications, their experience, and their price. So it's everybody wants to be at the table. But nothing comes for free. There are some challenges. So there is a higher level of owner expertise needed. Actually, in the legislation, in the statute, we have to have somebody that has more experience than we currently have. So we have Parametrics helping us with this. We're growing our team. In the future, we'll be able to do that without Parametrics on board.
Parametrics?
Parametrics is a consultant that does GCCM projects. Jim Dugan came and presented to the board a couple years ago. So Jim's our kind of our guide through this process the first time, required by the statute. Now as our team gets more experience, they're going to be able to do that without having Parametrics on board to help us, although they're a nice safety net to have.
What's the cost of that, Dan?
The cost for the two hydro projects together was about $90,000 to have Parametrics. And now we actually haven't even spent that. That was the value of the contract. I think we've spent maybe 30 or 40 of that. But we have a contract just as things come up, we can consult with them, find out what they would do in that situation. But we are required to have that until we have successfully completed the project on our own.
And the next time around, we may not need to use them at all?
Correct. I would suggest that it's nice to have them. They've done over 100 of these projects, so it's nice to be able to talk to somebody that's encountered something that we haven't.
Commissioner, I would also say that the perspective is good because Jim Dugan actually sits on the PRC for the state who makes decisions about what projects can go forward, so he brings that perspective as well.
It's been a very valuable contract.
Yep. Yeah.
We're learning, and it's been very helpful.
Yeah, I would suggest you keep that relationship. So there is a difference in the collaboration and trust in a normal design bid build contract. There is a kind of an adversarial relationship. You build it, you bid it, you know. This is more of a collaborative, so that's a little bit different. It requires more meetings, and we all love meetings, but more upfront meetings. But in the end, it should give us a better product. And then there's a perceived lack of competition. And this is something we're all aware of because larger contractors tend to get these. But they have a very robust outreach to smaller contractors. One of the things we evaluated the GCCMs on is their record in involving small local firms in their projects. So we did see that with Leidig at the Rock Island project. They brought in dirt work contractors, local contractor, other contractors. Local contractors are doing a lot of that work. And so we're seeing the same for the other projects, that they have a really strong outreach for local.
Can you put a percentage by any chance on that?
That's a tough one. It's easier just to kind of break down the individual pieces. Rock Island, the dirt work's a substantial part of the work, and that was Selland, Hearst Construction. At Rocky Reach, it was Selland. Rocky Reach still has its next package to go out in terms of being able to see what percentage of that is provided by local firms. But some of the things like electrical or mechanical, we don't have some local firms that are big enough to compete, although we are looking at a local firm working on the service center project in the electrical realm. So it's hard to tell. You know, I think we're going to have three different levels of that work for the three different projects. But we can come back and let you know what that is.
Yeah, how do you get that word out there so that the local contractors know that there's a place for them, that they can slip in?
We actually asked the GC to do that and show us how they're doing that, how they're engaging. So we did a call for electrical, advertised and said, we're looking for an electrical contractor for the service center project. And we had a local firm say, I think we're big enough to do that. And so they submitted on it, and they're going through the process right now. So one of the things is the quality of the subcontractor bid packages. It's different. We don't have as much control as we normally would have on a contracting package. So that's kind of the challenge for us, is not having the level of control that we currently have.
The design build process is prescribed by the RCWs. There's a few more steps than in the GCCM. The state approves the project, just like under GCCM. And then we go into a statement of qualification. So then, again, that's an advertisement that anybody can solicit under. It's open to all. From that, you can select. It doesn't prescribe. It has to be more than one. A number of folks go forward with the proposals. We selected three for the Rock Island project. In that phase, you do about 0 to 20% design. The contractors are paid for that. They're paid a stipend. That amount is established up front. It's a number we share with the state. We agree on that, and the contractors all know what that is. And as long as they provide a proposal, then they're paid that stipend. Once they submit the proposals, then we have to select one of the firms to go forward as the design builder. In that phase, it's just the design phase. We haven't guaranteed yet that they'll actually get to build the project. And in that phase, we want to advance the design. It doesn't prescribe how far, but we want to advance it so we make sure we've done life cycle cost analysis. We think we've looked at all the alternatives. And then once we think that design is advanced enough, then we work with them to solicit pricing. And so we believe we have a hand in that. It's not just pricing from them. We plan in our project to have them solicit for pricing from other, where they can, for sub-suppliers. Once they come up with a guaranteed maximum price, the owner can evaluate that, decide whether they agree on it or not. If they think they do, then they go forward with the commercial conditions. And if both of those are agreeable, then they actually sign an amendment to go forward and build the project. So some of the benefits that we see in using somebody else to help with that design, as opposed to us hiring a consulting firm, it's because the owner and maybe many consulting firms aren't really very familiar with the alternatives. And that happens a lot in the world of hydro generating units, because there's only very few people that build them. The projects are few and far between. For us, it's been about 40 years at Powerhouse 2. And bulb units are very unique, and we're trying to do all the work in an operating environment. This also allows the owner to get very familiar with the owner's needs in their operating environment. So we have a lot longer period. We can bring in the different proposers and have them actually collect information and data, see how we operate it. What we see is when we didn't know what technologies were out there by going through the process, we were really enlightened on what's available and what's possible with new technology and cooling and heating and sealing and safety features. And that we get to have proprietary collaborations with each one of those proposers. And so that's not allowed at all in the design bid build process. It's everything's open, fair, everybody gets to hear, and you don't get that sharing of innovation. And that's what's really important to us, is each of these vendors has made their niche in the industry on what they do and what they can provide. And the only way to get that is if you can have these proprietary meetings. And so we had four of those with each of our vendors. We really got to learn the strengths and weaknesses. We got to be able to visit the design facilities, their manufacturing facilities. And so instead of getting into a pretty serious relationship, on one date, we get to have a long period by which we get to see which one of these contractors can do the best job for us. Some of the challenges, there's been a lot more process. So from getting the state involved, as well as we've been working with multiple proposers. So instead of working with one firm on the design like we would with a consultant, we've actually been having to manage, in our case, three. So we've had three times the effort. Each one, again, has their way they want to design it, and it's taken a lot of effort on our part to work with each one of those and stay engaged and learn and ask questions. So it took us about 4 months to work through the RFQ phase, and we're about 7 months into the request for proposal phase. And so a lot longer than if we just would have advertised like we did on B1 to B4. And about a third of that time, we came up with our performance spec, went out to bid, and had somebody. And so in our process, we could have had somebody last summer with a guaranteed price, and we're moving forward with design. Some of the challenges, again, are that when we get to the end of the process, it might be that we aren't satisfied with the price proposal or their design, or we can't agree on commercial terms. And there's some risk in that happening because you're down to one proposer, so there's less competition, we feel, at that point.
So we're going to take you real quickly through some case studies, and Brett touched a little bit on the Rock Island project there, but in Powerhouse too. On the Rock Island facilities project, first project in the state done by a PUD GCCM, so we were paving new ground. It wasn't typical because we started the project without the GC on board. We did some of the work, and so this is where it's a little harder to extract as many lessons learned because it wasn't typical. We started their involvement late. But what we did learn was the C-19 building, which was added late in the project, we probably would not have been able to add that had we done a regular design bid build project. The GC was ready. They knew there was additional scope. They had performance turnaround on getting us pricing, and we were able to do an amendment to the GMP very quickly. Would not have been able to do that. We're also learning a lot about the contract change process, and one of the biggest takeaways is we need our GC on earlier. With Rocky Reach, similar, but we did get the GC on long enough before the small site package went out and the fuel island package went out. So we are seeing some added benefit that we didn't see on Rock Island. Early value engineering, very important. We've been talking with them early on about budget reconciliation. We still have to learn more about site conditions. We still have to look at our sequencing and phasing, and letting the GC help us more really make those decisions early on. So we're finding out good things, and the cost reconciliation is very much helping us with our cost certainty, and that's a big part of it. For the operations and service center, this is definitely a more typical GCCM. It's like a lot of the schools you see where you bring the GC on early in the process. High level of involvement from subcontractors or potential subcontractors, very early cost reconciliation. It's given us a lot of certainty around what we do and don't know about the project. And these early constructability reviews are helping us design the actual building. So we know the materials we're going to use. We know how we're going to sequence and phase things. And they're really bringing those value engineering. Every meeting we have something about value engineering. It's not something you do right at the end. So we definitely are seeing the benefits of this project.
So Dan, are these all, these lessons learned on the Operations Service Center, these are all positive? These are all positive?
They are. They are. We have yet to see anything where we said, I wish we would have done it the other way.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So our case study is the Powerhouse 2 Rehabilitation Project. So last January, we did an advertisement requesting qualifications. And so we tried to challenge the industry, and was there a different way to do this? From our engineer's estimate, it looked like most of the cost was with disassembly and reassembly of the units because there's some submerged bulbs very difficult to get into and out of. And so we actually cast the net pretty broad and tried to find big industrial mechanical contractors that build big chemical plants, nuclear plants, those kind of things, to say whether maybe they would be the best lead as the design builder and maybe subcontract to an equipment supplier. And so we spent quite a bit of time trying to get people interested, involved. We had lots of meetings. They came out. In the end, though, we only had three solicitations come in, and they were the Andritz, the GE, and the Voith. And so we didn't, from the industry, it didn't look like that it was beneficial because there was, again, so much specialization in this that the risk was too great for others to carry one of those entities as a subcontractor. We had originally proposed that we would just pick two and go forward with that proposal stage. After we did our evaluation, we went ahead and decided to advance three. One of the things that we did, again, in building this relationship is we let all three come into the plant and instrument and collect data on operating units and then go analyze that data and then come report back to us. That was hugely valuable. In that often we've specified what it is that we think that they need to design to. And this gave them the opportunity to collect data to actually put back into their, challenge their assumptions, to look at the design criteria that we've typically said versus what they think they need to do design. And so for several months after that data analysis, we had lots of great discussions and had lots of lessons learned that there's no way we would have come across until maybe after disassembly or even running the first unit. That first one was that we actually identified why we had the stator failure back in the late 70s after those units were first designed. If you recall, we actually, after 10 years, had to take them out with a completely redesign. And so what we learned, and all three independently came up with the same solution, is that we had a resonating frequency because of the number of slots that was designed in those windings. Well, before we went into this process, we were saying those things operate very well and have lasted a long time. We want exactly the same. And so this was great to know.
At the end of the day, with all of this analysis they're doing and we're actually paying, who owns the data?
We do. Yep. That's part of our stipend.
From all three.
Yep. For this phase, they've already given us reports and analysis that we own and can use going forward. So again, having multiple contractors, they all came up with a similar conclusion on what our results were in that case study. And so that helped us reformulate our scope. And as we're going forward, we can do a better job in getting the right design as we go forward. Also, what we were able to challenge them with is warranties. 3 to 5 year warranties haven't worked for us. We challenged them and requested that they come up with, how can we get a 10 year? How can we get a 20 year? How can we get a lifetime warranty? And that's a requirement to fulfill the proposal. And so we've gotten lots of great information on how that can be possible. So again, some of the lessons learned is it's taken a long time to go through that process, but the information has been invaluable. It also opened the door to the oil-less turbines. And so we had made an assumption up front. We said, we don't want to go down that path. Don't even think about it. In that process, they kept offering that and suggesting why we should do it, why the technology is feasible, possible. And so that convinced us, and we opened that door up to them also. And so we're also getting proposals for that as well.
And in the interest of time, I'm going to suggest this package, or this particular page was in the package. It just reviews that the board is engaged in different places in the decision-making process. If you have questions, we can talk about that later. But I'd suggest that we just go ahead and move on to the conclusions.
Okay. So the conclusions. So it should be a more efficient process. There's more effort in the initial stages, but in the end, you reap the benefits during construction. We make better design decisions because we're fully engaged with who would build it for us. There's better cost certainty because we're always having iterative cost reconciliations. And so far, most of those benefits have been realized, or where we haven't realized them, we do know why. And so our expected project outcome is bringing the best value for the cost, less contract changes during construction. And so that's really the case of using GCCM.
For design build, again, this is the process you want to use when there are very few entities that really have that specialized design expertise. You can't get it anywhere else. We think design competitions greatly encourage greater innovation and awareness. Compared to us to soliciting something and saying, here's what we want, we've gotten lots of feedback and changed our perspective on what we want to get moving forward. We again get the chance to evaluate the pros and cons of these different firms. And we expect the outcome to be a much improved project performance, and through the design, through the construction, we expect schedule to be much better, prices to be much lower, much less change order work. We're considering some design build and GCCM for a few future projects. One of them is the Rock Island Spillway Modernization. We also have a powerhouse one generator lead replacement project. And then with hatcheries, because those are unique designs and innovations, we haven't done any of those for a long time. Those are kind of the areas where we think this is possible. We would have to get agency approval to do our next one. And then after that, if we can get certified, then we don't have to keep going back.
So our the legislation, as I mentioned, sunsets in 2022. So really what we're looking at over the next couple of years is to see how the industry looks to deal with this. And so one of the things we've seen in some conversations around the GCCM community is, can we just make this a permanent legislative change and not have it sunset every 2, 3, 4, 5 years? And so there'll be either, or maybe both, an effort to extend the sunset date or possibly the effort to make this a permanent type of procurement that you don't have to go and visit it every few years. So we haven't had any conversations with WAPUTA yet. The PUDs have not availed themselves of this very much until just recently. So I'm not sure.
WAPUTA is aware.
Is great.
As of last week.
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
It could be a food education committee topic.
Could be.
So we'd love to see this become the permanent way we can do these more complex projects. With that, any questions?
Commissioners, questions?
Well, I think you guys did a great job. Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks for giving us a few extra minutes.
You're welcome.
Questions, please feel free.
Thanks, guys. All right. Thank you. I think at this point what we should do is adjourn for lunch and be back here at 1 o'clock to kick off the afternoon. So we are adjourned. Welcome to the January 20, 2020 business session of the Chelan County PUD Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone, please take this opportunity to silence any electronic devices you may have with you today. We place great value on public input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, please step forward to the microphone across from me. Please state your name and your address, and if you would, limit your comments to 3 minutes. This morning, we have a spillover of some topics that are going to spill over into the business afternoon session. Steve, would you like to pick up on that?
I think where I'd suggest we start is weight rates planning, because we have advertised and let folks know that we'd be talking about rates planning this afternoon.
Okay.
Go there and then come back to
come back. Okay.
From this morning.
All right.
So if that's okay. So with that, I'd invite Lindsay Mons to come up, and we will do. You may recall that we had a discussion about rates at the last meeting. We'll have a more detailed discussion today around the specifics. Lindsay, turn it over to you.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, commissioners. As Steve mentioned, we're in a process of... Sorry, this chair doesn't adjust. Okay, we're just going to go with it. I'll feel really tall. Okay. Anyway, starting over. This meeting continues our rate planning process, which is a continuation, really, of our strategic planning, where we set the long-term planning targets. So we are talking about the process to implement that plan. At our last meeting, or our last meeting was on January 6th. Today, January 20th, is the next in the progression. So we'll talk a little bit more in detail about rates today in advance of a public hearing, which the board has already set for next public meeting on February 3rd at 1 p.m. So a review of what we talked about at the last meeting. We went through some of the background on strategic planning and really made several recommendations associated with that. On the electric side, looking at our residential class separate from our commercial, industrial, and other classes. And on the residential side, focusing our rate discussion really in the customer charge, which is the basic flat amount. And then in the other rate classes, looking at a flat percentage increase. Also looking at 4% increase in water wastewater systems and 3% in fiber. As we go through this, we will also be looking at our low-income discounts and adjusting those accordingly. So today we'll go into a little more detail in most of these areas. First, we'll start on the electric. Just as a reminder from strategic planning, really where this originated from, was the discussion in the topic teams of the changing face here in Chelan County on the residential side. So we are seeing more and more seasonal homes, vacation rentals, those type of homes. And we're also seeing more distributed resources such as solar panels or other home generation and increased conservation. And all of these things aren't part of the assumptions in our rate design. So our rate design assumes, you know, the good old-fashioned energy usage that we've always seen here in the county. And as we get more different types of residential uses, that design doesn't work out quite the same. So we see that the minimum cost to serve those customers doesn't change as their use changes. However, how we charge them, if it remains the same, we are not recovering all of those costs associated with service. Historically, we've put a fair bit of that in the usage charge, so your monthly KWH charge would recover that. As the use of power changes, that's where we start to see the cost recovery breakdown. So through the strategic planning topic team, there was consideration of adjusting the rate components like the customer charge and the usage charge to better align with our cost recovery. And that's really where the recommendation originated, associated with looking at rate design in the residential class. So the customer charge, which is where we settled on as far as focusing our rate action or proposed rate action, really is designed to recover those costs of connection for the customer. So if they were to use no energy, no kilowatt hours, what would it cost us to just have service available ready to serve those customers? Those are things like our meter operations, maintenance, replacement, transformers, meter reading costs, customer billing, customer service, all of those types of things. So as we move forward in talking about the customer charge, you know, that's what we want to think about in that area. We also looked at our components, as I mentioned, as the face of the county changes, we're not recovering cost in the right areas. So we did talk about this at our last meeting, the residential cost recovery, where we see the customer charge recovery dropping more rapidly than we see the cost recovery for usage charge dropping, so that the alignment is in the future forecast. Well, they're just not aligned. We're also lagging on the industry alignment, which is where our customer charge is far less than other utilities are seeing, whereas those costs to serve the, you know, the ready-to-serve costs should be fairly similar from utility to utility. So looking at our charge compared to other public utilities, we are down there at the bottom. Our current charge is $7.70 a month. So all of those things in consideration. We are proposing on the residential side a 3% class revenue increase, but allocated to the basic charge. And what that looks like is $1.75 per month per year within a five-year rate plan. This increases the total average residential bill from about $55 right now up to $63.75 in the last year of the plan. We would also propose increasing the low-income discounts accordingly. From $9.25 currently up to $10.70 in year five. Our current low-income program is focused on our senior and disabled customers. We have other plans underway to study all low-income customers, and we'll be bringing that back to the board later in Q1.
Just to add that that $9.25 going to $10.70 keeps the percentage discount at roughly about the same level.
So how did we get to $1.75, you might ask? We looked at the 2018, which is our most current audited financial information. So our residential revenues in that area, excluding taxes, and our customer number of residential customer service agreements, and applied that 3% per year to that revenue amount. So it's about a little over $750,000 in the first year. This is approximately half of the total impact of the 3% rate proposal on electric. So half of it comes from our residential group and half from all of our other classes. So about $1.5 million total is what we're looking at. But on the residential side, that first year breaks down to about $1.66 per customer per month. And then each year of the plan, you see that increasing slightly. And when we average out all 5 years, it's about $1.76. So for ease of understanding, you know, it's an easy number to remember in your head. The $1.75 per month, we would propose that it just be equal across all years.
Lindsay, you haven't got it in here. I've scanned forward, and it would be interesting at some point to see how this rate increase would impact the left-hand chart on page 6, the gap?
I do have that information. You're correct. It is not in the chart. So this is where we want to take into consideration, and which I didn't mention in a previous slide and should have, that it was proposed that all of the revenues associated with the rate increase that we are discussing on the electric side be placed in a designated fund to protect against future rate increases. So while it will level out the difference, in reality...
the gap remains.
Yes.
Yeah.
So just a little bit more on low-income impact. That is something that we always consider with our rate plans. As mentioned, we would adjust the low-income discounts, propose adjusting those with the rate action in phase one here, and continuing with our studies of low-income energy efficiency and assistance programs through Q1. We have seen other utilities undertaking some of these studies, and those studies have found a low correlation between income and energy usage. So that is what we're expecting to see. We will report back and let you know exactly what comes out of that. But for the time being, anticipating that those low-income customers will be impacted in a similar way as all of our customers. So moving from the residential group into our other rate classes, applying a 3% rate increase to each of the rate elements, which are our customer charge, which we've talked about. Many of these classes have a demand charge, which is reflective of the peak amount of power at any one moment that a customer needs. And then an energy charge, which is the usage-based KWH charge. So applying that 3% across the board on those changes the average impacts in those classes, as you see on the table here. So our commercial group going from about $200 a month up to $232 in the fifth year of the plan, and so on. I do have irrigation and frost protection in here. And as a reminder for those groups, we don't bill those every month. We only bill those during the season in which they're being used. So this is the average per month, but only for that particular time frame. So for irrigation, for example, from April to September each month in that period, it would go from $180 a month to $209, give or take. Our other classes in electric, our HDL and our cryptocurrency, HDL being our high-density loads, we don't really have an average in these areas because they are so diverse. We do see them using their power the same, but size-wise, plus we have some different rate elements in this group. So I have a table here. Which is a preliminary estimate of the rate impact associated with these classes. They are still going through rate design, and we'll have more information at the next board meeting. But so the basic charges, these are the customer charges per meter per month, increasing in each of the three areas. Monthly demand charge, which is the per kW peak demand from $550 per month per kW to $640. Our, when we proposed and worked with the board on a cryptocurrency rate earlier in 2019, we proposed a residential cryptocurrency demand charge, which is scheduled to go into effect in April of this year. Through this rate planning and action, we would propose today to defer that at least 1 year, both from the impact it would have on our current CIS implementation project, just the challenges of implementing a residential demand rate in that area. And we're also seeing lower customer participation in residential services than we anticipated at the time of rate action. So we would propose keeping that placeholder for the future if needed, but deferring the rate increase on residential cryptocurrency for now. The energy charges on the high-density load energy charge, applying the 3% to that, would increase from 2.7 cents per kWh to 3.2 cents per kWh. And all of these charges, we did, because this is a cost-based rate schedule, we did ensure that they are still in alignment with cost in those areas, and they are. on the cryptocurrency energy charge, which is not a cost, well, it's a cost-based, but it's an energy cost-based, so market-based energy. It is adjusted on an annual basis, so we don't use our forecasted energy cost, but instead set that based on the market price of energy on December 15th every year for implementation starting April 1st. So it's currently 5.49 cents per kWh, and it is increasing April 1st to 5.55 cents. All right, so moving on from electric into water. So on the water side, if you recall, we did propose a 4% increase to each of the rate elements in water. And these, the information that we presented back in the summer, we did some analysis with that 4% rate increase, which on the graphs in front of you is the kind of yellow colored lines. And applying that 4% rate increase to current forecasts, we have shifted slightly. So this is the gray line is the forecast at the time of the strategic plan approval. So I'm including all of the elements of the strategic plan into our forecast. Changes cost slightly. We also see costs increasing slightly in the water department, mainly in the cost for leak repairs. So we're not seeing the volume of leak repairs increasing, but the cost to repair them is. So the magnitude. We're hoping that trend reverses, but as of now, this is what our forecasts look like. So our operating ratio, which was one of the metrics presented this summer, our target would be to be above 110% by the end of a 10-year plan. So not just the five-year rate plan now, but potentially considering additional discussions in the future. So at the end of a 10-year plan at 4% per year, we would be achieving that target, and still in both situations. On the debt service side, we see our debt service improving slightly. So we want to be below 10%. Oh, sorry, backwards. the yellow line is the previous, the gray line is the current. So we actually see the debt service percent not improving. And that is because we are needing to borrow funding in order to meet liquidity requirements in that system. So our minimum liquidity is $1.25 million, so we are borrowing on an annual basis to meet that target. That increases debt on the system, which increases the debt service as a percent of revenue. And as a reminder, debt service as a percent of revenue is really what percent of the customer's bill is going to pay debt. Do you recall assumptions associated with this analysis where the shared asset funding for things like the facilities is not charged to the small systems. And it also assumes that in the future, beyond those large projects, that only 50% of that shared asset cost would be applied to the small systems. This also assumes a system development charge increase associated with new connections. And that's another topic that we'll be bringing back to the board later this quarter. So with that all in mind, we do continue to recommend the 4% rate increase in each of the elements, as well as a low-income discount increase for the senior and disabled group. So that changes our residential average on the water system from about $52 a month up to $62, so $10 over 5 years there, and increases the average commercial from $310 up to $376. And our low-income discount from $9.50 currently to $11.55 in year five. Moving to wastewater, again, the metrics that we discussed this summer. Forecasts have shifted in wastewater as well for some similar reasons associated with strategic planning, as well as the Peshastin plant project. We did incur some debt associated with that project. And those came in the form of low-interest loans from the state. So our operating ratio, the first graph here, it's fairly consistent. It doesn't quite get as high as we had hoped in the last years of this forecast and doesn't meet the 75% target, even at a 4% rate increase. But we knew that this summer, too. So that was a balance that we had discussed at that point. Our debt service increased slightly because of the loans with Peshastin. And while our liquidity graph looks a little crazy jumping around there. It really is just timing-based associated with loans and funding associated with the future Dryden project. So we do end at the end of the forecast in a very similar place. The assumptions in these scenarios also include the shared asset funding, similar to water. They assume that future large capital projects like Dryden would receive grant funding of at least 60%. And we'll be throughout this year talking more about that as we apply for loans on that or grants on that project. And there's also an assumption of either public power benefit or wholesale electric allocation of funding for the non-grant funded Dryden expenses. So in that system, the annual 4% rate increase on the various elements and the low-income discount are reflected in the table for the average customer's residential increasing from about $77 a month up to $93, and the commercial from about $500 to $609 at the year five. Low-income discounts increasing as well, and both in water and wastewater, similar to electric, that keeps a very similar percent of the bill being discounted for those low-income customers. On the fiber side of things, we are looking to increase core service revenues 3%, and Mike is coming up to provide a little more information.
Thank you, Lindsay. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications. Out of strategic planning, we did have the recommendation to raise the core services revenue by 3%. And so we looked at that and said that we didn't want to have to interpret the market for the retail service providers. We are applying this all to the aggregated bandwidth revenue charge. So we looked at the 2020 forecast for the service provider revenue of $7.5 million and based our calculation on that. That does include the growth that's forecasted for 2020. And then we carried that out. So for the first year, looking at a mid-year start on the rate, the base revenue that was forecasted from aggregated bandwidth was $2.48 million. So in year one, as it increased to 2.84 in the forecast, we took 6 months of that for the increase, which gave us $113,000 needed in 2020. And then after that, on the full years, you will see it climbs from $229,000 up to $251,000. And that represents an overall approximate 3% increase in the service provider revenue. So really simple, really straightforward for us.
Thank you. So,
thanks, Mike.
Perfect. Thank you. Following discussion today, our next steps would be the public hearing that was set by the board, and considering any feedback that we receive from the public associated with that. And in the meantime, 2 weeks later, if depending on the results of the feedback in the public hearing, if board direction remains unchanged, we would be back in the second meeting in February seeking approval of the rate. Implementation plans, water, wastewater, and fiber, we're targeting the end of May, and electric no later than the mid-December. However, we would like to get that in place as soon as we can for forecasting and all of that. But all of these dates really depend on the implementation of the CIS project, so our new customer information system, and the ability and timeline to get those rates programmed into the new system.
And we'll have an update on that during the manager's report. Okay.
So with that, do you have any questions? Or
commissioners, any questions, comments? As always, good job, both of you guys. Commissioner McKenna?
It's a newcomer question, so I can ask it later.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
As for public comment.
Is there any member of the public that would like to make comment?
Malachi Salcedo, Salcedo Enterprises, 615 C-1 North Wenatchee Avenue. Just want to add my comments that this is very well put together. I appreciate the long look and the rate of growth as far as the percentages. Those are palpable for businesses and large users. And I just want to say thank you for planning to avoid large unforecasted rate increases. Very much appreciated.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate that very much.
Commissioners, I would just add that we likely would have very little new material to present at the next meeting, because the idea is to have the information out there that the public can comment on and not be presenting new stuff that they haven't seen before. So I just wanted to make sure we set the expectations for you and you understood that next time around it would be a short presentation and straight into public comment.
Good.
Short presentation, huh? There we go.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay.
Commissioners, I would just suggest that we go to the consent agenda and take care of that piece, and then we would move back to the items that we missed from this morning's study session.
Okay. Well, Commissioners, we have a consent agenda before us. What is the pleasure of the board?
Would move approval of the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded and third did. Have any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The ayes have it.
What I'd like to do is move back to the, what was agenda item 7, Rock Island License Early Action Project Solicitation. Justin Erickson and Michelle Smith will be presenting.
Good morning. Excuse me. Good afternoon, commissioners. We're scheduled to present this morning, and so we know it's a little bit behind, so we'll try to go through this relatively quickly. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services.
And Michelle Smith, Director of Hydro Licensing.
Okay. Well, we're talking about relicensing and the opportunity that we have with Early Action, which you're familiar with, certainly, but I want to talk a little bit more about how we see implementation of the strategic planning component going into 2020. So the strategic plan provides the district will undertake a variety of activities relative to early action. Those actions must be identified and substantially advanced by 2023. And for 2020 specifically, we're looking at solicitation for potential recreational and environmental enhancements. And in the strategic plan, there is actually a direct notation that says that limited funding of approximately $125,000 is allocated to be able to evaluate and develop potential early actions. And we know that it's important to you and important to our customer owners that whatever we choose, if we choose to move forward with potential early actions, that we make sure that we maximize the license term and get that support from project proponents for a 50-year license. So our goals with early action are certainly to obtain a 50-year license. Also know that we have a project that we need to make sure makes economic sense and that we have cost certainty associated with the project and with mitigation activities and enhancement activities. Also, certainly want to maintain and enhance community relations. And we have a history here of approaching relicensing in a collaborative way, and this allows us to do that even more so. And as we do that, we're going to keep in mind our mission, vision, and values, which speak to things such as quality of life, the best for the most for the longest, and then our stewardship ethos. Our strategic planning process included a countywide survey, and in that survey we asked customer owners if we should make environmental and recreational enhancements along the Rock Island project as part of early action to support a longer license term, and a resounding 82% said yes, we should consider that. So what does that mean in terms of time frame? We're here before you this afternoon providing this update. We would propose that, barring any comments or resistance, that if you concur with this approach, then we would move forward with solicitation letters that we would send out to stakeholders. We would engage with those stakeholders in a kind of one-on-one fashion, be able to meet with them over the next couple of months, answer any questions that they have, outline the process that we have going forward. And then ultimately, those proposals would come in, say, in the March timeframe, would allow for us, for staff to review those submittals, get clarifying information as needed, and ultimately, in May, present to you information concerning the number of proposals that we received, and then our recommendation as staff in terms of how to allocate those funds, $125,000 relative to those next phase of preliminary studies and concept planning with particular stakeholders. That process then would take the better part of 2020 into potentially early 2021, depending upon the actual details of the preliminary studies. And then we would come back to you then and report on those findings, seek your concurrence to submit to FERC in mid-2021 for that early determination on whether or not those projects may be qualified as early action. And then later in the year, into next year, there would be then another project decision point that we would have before you before ultimately a license amendment would take place.
Could I,
yes, sir,
ask a question? And it's actually back a couple of slides. One of the strategic plan implementation is require commitments from project sponsors whereby they attest to their support for a 50-year license. And I'm thinking back, I've been a commissioner for 13 years now, and I'm looking around the room at employees that have been here long enough to remember the Rocky Reach, and Michelle, you're probably one of them. So, Justin, I'm not putting you on the spot, but the last go-around when we got a license, did we make that specific request for the 50-year license of the people that were, sponsors?
So the answer to that is we asked for support for a 50-year license, and for the most part, we got that from a lot of proponents. We didn't have early action then, but during the relicensing process, so we tried to get 50-year commitment for the settlement agreement. We could not get the agencies to agree. They could not say the word 50 years. We kind of laughed about that, but it was really a struggle for them to commit to a 50-year license. And so the language we came up with was a little bit more gray. It basically, they agreed to, it was funny, it was they wouldn't, I'm trying to remember what it was now, but it's not that they would not support a 50-year license. So they wouldn't support a 50-year license, but they wouldn't oppose it if we got it. So it was kind of something like that. So they wouldn't say they would support a 50-year, but they wouldn't oppose it if we ended up getting a 50-year license. And, of course, with Rocky Reach, FERC was really adamant that they were going to line up licenses on the Columbia. So we were right in line with being lined up with Grant PUD. So regardless of that, they chose to give us the 43-year license we see on.
See, if we want to line Rock Island, it might be a 70-year license.
Can't be done. We have already tested that with FERC, I'm not sure.
Your hypothesis is correct, though.
Here, yes, it is. So yeah, I think the point here is that if we can get local support to for a 50-year license, that would be wonderful, as much as we can. There's no guarantees that we can get agency support for that same, but we will certainly go for that. Now, 40 years is a new default also, so that's promising. So 40-year license is the new default license with the FERC based on their new policy. So we have to keep that in mind also.
This is just another look at the time frame, done a little bit more graphically. So indicating what we hope to accomplish in 2020 and then into 2021. It matches up well with the previous graphic, so I won't go into detail unless there's questions. And now we'll transition into a little bit more detailed schedule, looking at what exactly early action means compared to the standard relicensing schedule.
Okay, so I'm going to take this on. I wanted to provide some context. When we talk about early, what does that mean, and how does that work? So we tried to show a timeline on the top, showing early action schedule, a timeline on the bottom, which is normal relicensing. And the whole point of this is really that if we can get those license amendments into the FERC before 2023, when we file our notice of intent to start relicensing, which starts a formal proceeding with FERC, then we think that we can get the approvals we need for people to go, or for us to go do those early action projects. So it's critical that between now and 2023, we go through that initial evaluation screening, that we bring those projects back to the board. We determine which projects we want to push forward to maybe get some more feasibility and conceptual work done. At that point, we would put together a filing with the FERC to get a determination on whether or not it will work as early action. FERC has 60 days to respond. So once we get that, we would come back to the board with an update. And then we would, as staff, start working on a license amendment to our whatever resource plan we're changing to add this new proposal. And then we would seek FERC approval, and then the project can proceed to final design and construction. So I was just trying to give some context when we tell people that these are early from a time frame perspective. The other side of it is we wait through relicensing, and those projects actually can't start until we get the license, so that we're looking at it probably 2029 or later, depending on if we get annual licenses. There's going to be a set evaluation framework that staff is working to pull together now. The next three slides, I'm not going to walk through each one of these, but there's PUD criteria. There's going to be some FERC criteria, and then there's also criteria on the third slide that came out of our topic team last year. And so we will be building all of these factors, and specifically, we need to make sure that there is a connection to the Rock Island Reservoir and the Rock Island Project, but there's a lot of criteria here, and so we're trying to figure out a way, a tool that we can use to evaluate all these projects, and we can bring that information back to you when we get to that point.
And on this present slide that's up, just a reminder that as part of strategic planning and as part of our survey, when we surveyed the community, we had like a list of seven criteria that were developed with, and they were very consistent between the public power benefit topic team and the Rock Island relicensing topic team. And then we surveyed to see what criteria were most supportive from the public's perspective. And the top three are listed here: supports economic development, environmental stewardship, and recreational opportunities and public access. So that will certainly play into that criteria that Michelle described. Just a reminder on the Rock Island pool and the current project boundary. And I'm going to conclude then with proposed outreach. So this early action solicitation letter will be sent to parties that served on the topic team, and those are listed therein. The bottom bullet, of course, we know that there's others that there may be an opportunity to engage with as part of early action. So this list is not designed to be comprehensive, but rather be indicative of the parties that participated over that topic team process last year. So we look forward to engaging with these stakeholders and others, and bringing this information back to you in just a few short months. With that, are there any questions?
Commissioners, questions? Thoughts, comments? Like a good roadmap. Yeah. Well, good.
Okay. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Very informative.
Thank you.
All right.
With that, commissioners, we're finished with the combined study session. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I knew I was going to do that. We have one item left, and it's yours.
the quarterly scorecard.
We're done.
And you're on the top of the list there.
I am.
S1.
In the red. Oh.
Is that red?
Well, I apologize. I have not looked at it yet.
I assumed that we were up to snuff on all this. Let's see. I am red because, and I forgot my glasses today. Sorry, guys. I can see. So year to date is, so our target, we're talking about a key indicator, sustain our public partnership. Our target rate is 75%, and year to date we're at 60%. And Randy, will you help me? I can't read that. I can't read this right here.
Well, here we go. We can do that.
Would you like Rebecca? I think she could help with this.
Okay, the results true. Lower attendance in second and fourth quarters are due to scheduling conflicts because no meetings held first and third quarters. So, in other words, we'll pick up and probably meet
this
our...
This is year end.
Oh, it is year end.
We're done.
I apologize. I'm way behind the eight ball here, aren't I? Yeah. And we're done. Yeah. Thank you, Randy.
Yeah, we missed a couple.
We did.
And we will.
We'll pick it up. Last year we had a number of weather issues and illnesses, and I know I was out of town, just scheduling conflicts that got in the way with those meetings.
And the other thing that we talked about on this really quickly is that there are, less tangible kinds of things that we do that contribute to our public partnership, like belonging to service clubs and serving on boards. And in the process of doing that, you're having discussions and you're networking. And so that kind of thing gets done all the time, I think, with all five of us, which is not measured. So maybe that, we should throw that in too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to only report on the variance. Is that correct?
Yeah. All right.
So Dennis?
Same thing. Scheduling conflict has not allowed us to do the general counsel's evaluation. But we should schedule that as soon as possible.
I will.
I know Rebecca's on that.
I'll make mention that Rebecca and I had that conversation this morning, and you will all be getting a list of dates to see if they would work for your calendar so that we can tackle that topic.
Yeah.
So, Commissioners, one other thought. I've said several times, this one is actually green in my heart because we did do, depends upon the metric and how you evaluate it. So we had a formal date, not December last month, but December 13 months ago, where we did meet formally as a team. And normally those, we have a discussion and then you take away and provide feedback. And that feedback normally comes in January, which would make it green. Could not locate last year's feedback if it occurred. So in any event, it's something that we might consider in terms of how this is reported. It's just the way, I just will remind you all, the way it normally happens for my review is that usually occurs sometime after the district review process. So the once a year is not a bad metric. It always happens in a year. We've always done it since I've had this position. Just the timing is such that it isn't really perfectly conducive to a once a year metric. Unless we set a better descriptor than this, because there's usually two pieces of that, the discussion, which includes my presentation to you, and then the feedback from you. Generally, that spans the year and would have satisfied the green metrics this year. So I might put some thought into that and suggest something for you at the next workshop for a slightly revised metric.
That is a thought, too, to just include that as an agenda item on our next board workshop.
Okay. We got it.
Great. Thank you.
Because we just need to tighten it up. And it's not a lengthy thing. And it almost doesn't. Oh, man, how am I going to say this, Jim?
I appreciate it. Careful. I know where you're headed already.
it almost doesn't warrant the
that's right.
Process doesn't warrant the scheduling of a separate meeting. So
yeah, so normally we don't have a separate meeting. So it's just a process that we probably should talk about.
Sometimes the right words just don't.
I know. There's nothing wrong with that one. We've known each other a while now.
Yeah.
I'll survive.
Okay, on to the next topic. G3.
This was improvement Schedule conflicts came close, but we still can keep working on it.
Okay, and that
no concerns.
Nope.
Okay. I would just note that you know, the way we report this on the district performance is percentage complete, and so out of the 21 items, only three were not complete, which is an 86% rate of completion. So.
Thank you, Steve, for pointing that out. Okay.
And thanks to Rebecca for all of the tracking she does on all the other charts down below. I definitely appreciate that. We can keep adding to that list, too.
And the reminders ahead of time will help us keep on track, so yeah. I appreciate that.
Yes, same here. Okay.
With that, we're up to the place where I thought we were going to be 5 minutes ago, which is manager items. John Wasniewski is going to give us an update on the runoff. So recall that we pulled the runoff from the quarterly energy resources report, and what we thought is if there's a significant, a really big change, we would bring it to you, and we thought this one was significant. So John, take it away.
Thank you. John Wasniewski with the Energy Planning and Trading Group. First slide here is just kind of a big regional look. You can see my mouse up there. At snow water equivalent, which is how we monitor snowpack. What I wanted to point out here is just the difference in the two forecasts we usually look at. We usually look at Lake Chelan and then at Grand Coulee for an indication on the river. And Lake Chelan is just one small basin located generally in this area here where Grand Coulee is about here. But Grand Coulee, keep in mind, it encompasses a lot of northern Idaho into western Montana as well as up into Canada. So the watershed of the basin that makes that forecast is quite a bit larger and more diverse than for Lake Chelan. So when we see divergence in the two forecasts, just something to keep in mind, although they are geographically close. For Lake Chelan here, as Steve mentioned, about a month ago, we were down in the 70s. Well, to back up, this long line across the screen here is just a daily water supply forecast over time. So the water year began October 1st. And you can see it started off near average, kind of dipped down, and has recently come back up. So, again, in the 70s to low 80s for quite a while, just in the last couple weeks to a month, we have seen an increase for a while up to near 100%, and more recently here, about 90% of average. So for Lake Chelan, really this means at this point we're following the dry and average target curve. We do have a snow survey coming up as well. This isn't included in this data. We put out our own internal forecasts, but this is the Northwest River Forecast Center look. For Grand Coulee, fairly similar. We were down here in the high 80s, low 90s in the daily forecasts. And since then, again, in the last several weeks, we have come up to 100 and even above 100% of average is the current forecast for the Columbia River. 103 here is the most recent. And really, pretty quick update there, again, just to highlight that improvement in the water supply forecast. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
It's amazing how fast it changes.
And that's a good point, is early in the year, it really can change quickly. It's something that we always track and watch, but particularly early in the year, there's still even now a couple months left of time for snowpack to build and for conditions to change. So still early, but something we certainly continue to monitor.
Projecting somewhere around 80-85% by the end of April, May. For, is that the projection, that we'll fall somewhere around 85%?
For which basin?
For Lake Chelan.
For Lake Chelan, we're currently forecasting about
90%. 90%. Okay, so, cool.
And again, we'll go up at the – it's actually next week we have a snow survey plan. We give a – you know, go take manual measurements in the basin up there and put out our own internal forecast. But 90% is where – what we are currently forecasting and what the Northwest River Forecast Center is.
You know, I'm one of those odd people that has Northwest River Forecast Center that I pull up on a semi-regular basis. And it's amazing. Last week, you were right. It was
85.
It was 84 last week, and it jumped
and now it's 90.
6 percentage points in a week. So,
and that is something I notice. I check daily or more frequently sometimes as well. And I think just because of the nature of it, it's such a small basin in Lake Chelan as opposed to a very large watershed for Grand Coulee, sometimes I'll look and it will jump daily sometimes in quite quite frequently, particularly for Lake Chelan, whereas Grand Coulee, I think just because of the larger watershed area, it tends to move, you know, a little bit more slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So,
did you see how excited John got when you guys started?
So how do you pronounce your last name?
Wasniewski.
Wasniewski. Wasniewski.
Good Polish name for you.
Polish, okay. I thought it was Serbian. No, Polish. Wasniewski.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, great.
Thank
good
you,
job. John.
Thanks.
Next up, I want to give you an update on customer information system. John Stoll is going to come up with that.
The weather.
Good afternoon, commissioners. I believe 2 weeks ago I was here just informing you with the C2M, Customer Information System project, that we were entering our final stages. Hence today, the lobby and the customer-facing options are closed, just anticipating we would be going live tomorrow. Well, that didn't happen. Frankly, from a staff perspective, the training, the testing, we're ready to go. They're pretty disappointed we couldn't go. What happened is we had some Oracle patches that came through. Since this is a relatively new product, well, it's very new, they're constantly in development and putting out patches and fixes. We had a series of them. They went in, and during our testing process, we uncovered some billing issues. So Oracle responded with another turnaround of a patch that was installed. Unfortunately, it fixed some of the issues and created a new one. As we speak, they're still working on installing and uploading the new patch to, again, start testing, with the anticipation that we would go out 2 weeks and anticipate on February 7th starting the next go-live. So that's where we're at. Again, I know staff is disappointed. They were ready to go. But it does allow a little bit more opportunity to continue to train and get comfortable with the system. They're doing that today, as well as just some other updates that's nice to do when we have this opportunity using Martin Luther King Day. So just want to let you know that's where we stand. And, again, we're ready to go live, hopefully on February 7th, or the weekend starting of that.
I would just like to congratulate you and at the same time thank you for having the ability to step back, that I know you wanted this to happen. And I know you wanted to go live today, and it is better to get this right the first time than it is to just adhere to some deadline. So as one commissioner, I want to say thank you, because the mere fact that we're not going live today gives me greater confidence that when we do go live, it's going to be seamless, because you guys are really taking it seriously. So thank you for doing that.
Well, it's a team effort, and appreciate those comments, and I'll be certain to pass them on. But, again, thank you.
Thanks.
Jokingly, I was thinking Ryan Roy wanted a bigger project.
next up, Eric's got something to report with respect to delegation of authority issue.
Yes, commissioners, thanks. Eric Walquist, General Counsel. So one of the things we've been talking about internally as staff here over the last 6 or so months has been a proposal to revisit one of the delegated authorities here for the district. Back in 2003, we set some limits for what we call down here charge-offs of accounts. We set those limits at $1,000, so anything that needed to be charged off over $1,000 would come for the board for board action. In 2008, that resolution was revisited, and we added all accounts. Initially, 2003, it was just electric. Then we added the rest of the accounts for charge-offs. I would say that since Steve has been inquiring and has to see all of those approvals before they come forward to the board, we've had an internal discussion about why is it that we bring those items at that level before the board, even though we've put a ton of work at staff into them prior to that, to make sure that we can collect what we can collect and that we're only writing off those absolutely required items, and I'll touch on those in a moment. So the short answer is we dug into it. Primarily Stacy Jagla and her team dug into the where do we think the right internal control needs to be given our other administrative processes. And she has come forward with a recommendation that we revisit those limits. I say she. We all agree to it. Stacy is the one that's done the majority of the legwork that we increase those. So next time you'll see a resolution proposed, and I will commit in the interim to sending you an updated memo giving you that analysis in email as well. But we would like to increase them to $15,000 for uncollectibles and really proposing no limits for the referral. And what I mean by that is when we use the term charge-off, we're referring to two types of accounts that need action. The first is not really a write-off. It is a referral, which means that we would take a previously unsuccessfully collected account and we would make a decision to refer that to an outside third-party collection entity, which is our common practice now. I don't really understand, candidly, why we ever needed board action for that. It's really an administrative referral. It just means we've exhausted all of our internal resources, and we believe we're best served by referring that outside. So that is one of the two types of write-offs that we're talking about. The second is really the write-off, and that is where we would forgive an account as uncollectible. Again, we have been at $1,000, proposing $15,000. The reason for that is, frankly, efficiency of internal staff time and review and the board time here at the meeting and in your review of your consent agenda. Whether we write off an account as uncollectible is generally, it only comes after exhaustion of both internal and external collection efforts. And it's actually driven by two things, a legal review of the reason for a write-off, things like statute of limitations, things like there's been a bankruptcy and a forgiveness in bankruptcy, or there's some other accounting principle that has driven that amount. Those only happen infrequently, candidly, after exhaustive administrative review, including senior staff review. I can actually only think of one more than 15,000 in recent years that we have addressed. Those would still come to the board at above the 15,000. Below the 15,000, though, we're just proposing to delegate that to the general manager or his designee. So those are the two types of efforts. And just for clarity, the distinction being on the first, where it's simply an administrative referral to outside collection, proposing really no limit to that. It's an administrative function, always has been here, just as a line item on your agenda. And then the other is forgiveness or writing off of a debt as uncollectible after those efforts, which again we're just proposing to increase the limit from 1,000 to 15,000. Questions about that? Concerns to be expressed? We actually have everything done and prepared, so I will try to get that to you in short order this week for your review in advance of the next board meeting, and invite any questions that you might have about the processes of internal controls that we currently go through. There's a long litany you might expect as to how we address that before it ever comes to the board, but happy to share that if you.
So that'll come to us as a resolution for the next board.
Yes, it will need to be a resolution. We have the most recent resolution is the 2008 resolution, which actually rescinded and replaced the 03 resolution, but only to include all accounts as opposed to just the electric accounts commissioner. So, and it's in draft, and I'll provide it for you sufficiently in advance with my email.
I was just going to make a motion today, but we need to go through that correct process and rescind the other one, and et cetera.
Yes, and if you have no questions or concerns among the interim, you're often welcome to just simply add it to your consent agenda at the next board meeting. And again, I'm ready to answer any questions you have in the interim.
Looking into the future and realizing that we currently and haven't historically had a large number of these, this might seem like an insignificant question, but in the event that something unforeseen occurs in the future and we had a large number of these that all occurred below the $15,000 limit, would there be some kind of a summary report? Because collectively, they could amount to quite a bit if they're below that $15,000 limit.
So perhaps, Commissioner, so let me just back up and say, I think summary reports are always available at your discretion. Perhaps it would be best before we made that decision. I'll send you along with my email a summary of the activity we've had so you can see it's possible, yes, that we would have a large run of these and we would bring that to your attention, revisit it, whatever the case may be. Historically, that's not been the case. It's been very small. And the only reason I say that, just to be very candid, is the hesitancy to replace one process with another process and generate another periodic report.
So the question might be, a way to streamline this is, in the resolution address, that if there was an abnormally large number of these, that might be brought to the commission. And that way we're not doing a summary report, but we are putting it in writing that if something happens that's unforeseen and a lot of these pop up, it'll be brought to our attention.
Okay. I'll take that back.
Yeah, I think it's more of a, it's not a dollar amount that concerns me as much as it is a public perception that the commission would know or not know what was being charged off. So I'll have to give that some thought.
Fair.
Okay. Last item, I'm going to ask Kirk to come up. So to say that we're very focused, as we've talked about at a previous meeting, getting units back online. We've got something coming forward the next meeting. Just want to give you a heads up that a resolution that will be coming forward that does have timeliness associated with it. So, Kirk.
Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. And just like the last discussion, I just wanted to give you early indication of a resolution coming forward to the next board meeting. It is a result of our efforts to build in resiliency capability as things continue to change at the hydro facilities. And we experience some of the aging and failures that we've seen. You might recall that we identified a need for additional set of head gates, and they're actually in the budget for 2020. The estimates are coming out somewhere between $2.8 million and $3.2 million. The board's authority is anything over $3 million would get advertised. So given that the range is a little bit above and a little bit below, we thought it was best to bring it to the board in case it does end up on the higher range. But it is to purchase another set of head gates at Rocky Reach. With the trunnion and bushing failures we've seen, we are greatly limited right now with the existing set of head gates. We've got four sets, and we keep one in reserve in case there's an emergency runaway situation, so we can only have three sets deployed at any given time. And out of those three sets, we reserve one for unplanned maintenance, so we try not to commit all three of those for longer term outages in case something small pops up and we can respond with a fix in a day or so. So we really could use an extra set of head gates so that we can do more of these smaller trunnion bushing blade projects and still keep a set in reserve for those small outages to try and get a unit back up in service right away. So that's what will be coming forward. And as Steve mentioned, time is critical on these. Right now it's not hindering us because we still have a couple weeks worth of work to get a bid package put together. But then come the next board meeting, we'll be ready to advertise pretty darn quick after that. So I wanted to just give you an early indication and let you know if you have any concerns, just please let me know. Thank you.
How long does it take to get those delivered?
That's what we're going to find out with the bid. I would suspect it's going to take us probably at least 6 months to a year. Last time it took us a year. So good thing on we have part of the design already done because we ordered a set not too long ago. This will be slightly different because we don't need the roller bearings like we needed on the other set, which will reduce some of the costs, but be somewhere between 6 months and a year. And we'll probably use them as soon as we get them.
Kirk, are those made in the United States, or where's the manufacturer?
They're usually made in the United States. Steel comes from all over the world and then gets fabricated and assembled. Could be here, could be elsewhere in the world, too.
Sure.
But,
okay.
Yeah, steel usually gets purchased from outside the U.S. Yeah.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's it for our manager items.
Okay, we're on to commission items. Yes.
Well, the management team is still here. I thought I might share one item from our last week's PUD Association meetings. At our board meeting on Friday, we spent an hour and a half plus discussing one item guided in that setting by Robert's Rules of Order. which tells you a lot. At the end of the day, we voted to approve the PUD Association's talking points for our upcoming federal delegation going in February, which included the item of supporting the Snake River dams, and that those talking points passed on a 19-1 vote. The one was the significant. So just we can share more, but we've up to this point in time had unanimity, but we definitely have discussions ongoing. That's my Waputa report.
Commissioners, any other questions? Okay. Follow up to delegation items.
We had a few from the last meeting. First of all, we have a commitment to get back to you on information about the seismic studies. There's a draft of that that I'm looking at. I've got a few questions about, so it should be here by the next board meeting, I think. The graphic that you wanted on current turbine status has been delivered. Information about fish stocking at Jameson Lake, which turned out to be kind of interesting, actually, the way that came about.
That was great. I didn't know that history. That was really great to see.
Yeah.
I mean, really, really fun. Yep, interesting. Yeah.
So that is there. And then we had some information to get back to you about contractor safety that Eric delivered to you as well. So those are now checked off the list. Unfortunately, that's three. And if we have
12.
If we have counted correctly, you have been a busy board today. We have 11 new items as of today's board meeting. So you might just check these and see if but you really want all of them. let's see, we've got one. Tim Pettit will determine how to improve the staff understanding of how to submit a safety concern, close call. We've got one to continue reporting on the annual safety concerns. That would be in the parking lot coming back, say, a year or so from now. Justin will add the Stehekin presentation to the next Tri-Commission meeting agenda. Andrew will provide additional characteristic information on the approved 2,000 amps of growth in Stehekin. So what were the projects there that folks are pursuing? We'll develop an outreach plan for Stehekin and come back to you to determine how all the pieces fit together. One of them, fortunately, Eric has already completed today, and that was to provide info on the current tiered rates in Stehekin. He just pulled information from the current rate schedule and sent that up. Andy Wendell will provide acreage for the Triad development. Dan Frazier will provide info on current construction work awarded to local companies. Lindsay will provide information on how this rating pack affects residential cost recovery. Rebecca will include, actually, let me just check on that one. Did Lindsay's answer on that satisfy? Was that enough? This is the one where you've got the base charge compared against the average rate.
I'd love to see. She said she has the graph.
Okay.
I'd love to see it.
Okay. Rebecca will include an agenda item at the next board workshop to review the general counsel performance review definition. And Eric will send a proposed delegation memo for charge-offs prior to the next board meeting, along with a summary of activities that we go through prior to entering into charge-offs for your review.
That'll just teach you to load us up with study items.
Boy, howdy, lesson learned. Commissioners, if you'll indulge me for 1 minute, one of the things I've just thought occurred to me in response to both Commissioner Bowles and Commissioner Arsenault's comment on the delegation level is, since we were proposing to bring it to you, if it was one single item more than 15,000, are we comfortable? Or think about it. You don't necessarily have to answer. But I thought it would be just as easy to say if we've collectively in a month got more than 15,000. So if you had a whole bunch of 1,000s or so forth that would add up to that, I can simply add that, and then you would have both. Not asking for you necessarily to answer today. It's just that's an easy way to address that problem.
I think, Commissioner Bowles, seeing the gears turn, you probably want some time to think about it.
No.
Oh, no.
I think that's satisfactory.
Okay. Okay. Good.
That's it.
Okay, so that was follow-up. Then we have delegation.
Yeah, I did cover both.
So now there are no public
No public in the room. We will need an executive session for how long?
Actually, we've said that we've resolved the one issue. We do not need executive session.
Oh. So.
Whoa.
Whoa. All right.
Randy, you're out of here. Oh, sorry.
If I conclude this meeting before the clock strikes, 10 after, I think that'll set a record. So, all right. We're going to go ahead and adjourn this meeting.